where I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. You are listening to the December 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, if you haven't already figured it out, my voice is pretty much trashed at the moment. Unfortunately, I have a show to record, so you're going to have to put up with my slightly scratchy voice, and I apologize for that. But it's been a very long December, and very busy December, and we have, fortunately, a very nice, almost two-hour interview with Michael Welch, the programmer behind Scorch Tanks on the Amiga, Pocket Tanks on the PC, and Android and iOS platforms. He's going to come and talk to us about what it's like to write software, both for the Amiga and for the new devices, where they're going, what they've done. It's very impressive. Good interview. I think you'll really enjoy it. We do have a little bit of reader mail, and we have a few reviews for you. But Bits and Bytes is suspended, as well as anniversaries this episode. So it's going to be a little shorter episode. It's going to be a little different episode. But just to try to save what little voice I have left, I think you'll still enjoy it. So anyway, stick with us. We have a really great show all the same. It'll just be slightly different, and you guys haven't had an interview in a while, so hopefully this will be a nice treat. So let's get on with the show. This month's reader mail comes from regular Vince Dickinson. Vince writes in, "Hey Shane, I love the segment about wall games and your quest to find info about Trapshoot. I worked for a small coin-op development house, CES, for a couple of years in the mid-90s, and they released a traditional big-box wall game in 1996. And he gives us a link to learn more about it. I'll post that for you on the site, called Trap Wall. Believe it or not, there was still demand for these games in the 1990s, and for the record, I met my wife at a bar that had a Trapshoot. I would play it occasionally with friends when we were there during off hours. Would we have chosen to go to that bar on that night if it weren't for the wall games they had? Who knows? Maybe we would have went to some other dive, and perhaps I never would have talked to my future wife. Thanks, Vince." Well, thank you, Vince. That's a really neat story. I wish I could say I met my wife over a game of Trapshoot, but I cannot. Remember Virtual Places? That's where I met my wife. That's old school. I'm almost ashamed to admit it. But anyway, remember, you can submit reader mail right through Retro Gaming Radio's website at retrogamingradio.com, and your letter might appear right here on the air. Thanks again, Vince. Now let's get on with the rest of the show. This month we have a real treat for you, an interview with classic programmer Michael Welch. And if the name sounds familiar, he was the developer of possibly one of the greatest shareware games of all time, Scorch Tanks, on the Commodore Amiga. I don't think anybody had an Amiga that did not have and at least play Scorch Tanks, or at least had heard of Scorch Tanks. Michael Welch is an active developer with mobile and computer games, and he's joined us for almost 2 hours, so enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio. I'm here with one of the shareware software legends, Michael Welch. You may have heard the name. You've probably played his games. If you were an Amiga lover back in the day, Scorch Tanks was probably on your Amiga. And Michael Welch is the brainchild behind that. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, Shane, and thanks for having me.
Well, it has been a long time, my old friend. We have been friends for what's the time here? I mean, we both had kids after we got to know each other, right?
Yeah, actually, as a matter of fact, I remember when we had our first child, you sent me a baby gift. I'm like, wow, that's awesome. So we still have that.
That's amazing. Yeah. And how old is your kid now?
14.
Wow.
Sorry.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And you're still married to your lovely wife, Sarah, is that right?
Oh, yeah. High school sweethearts and everything. It's been quite a blessing. And she endures my software development and games.
Well, you know, that's something special, right? I mean, not everybody will tolerate the sort of work hours and work ethics to do this sort of a job. So I think that speaks mountains to your about your relationship, if nothing else.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, it is. It is, and even now as we're trying to grow Blitwise to the next level, it's. I think all of what we did beforehand was just a test, just a proving ground for this ultimate experience of growing a company. So,
sure. Sure. Well, let's go back to the beginning. My listeners are a lot of my listeners love Amiga. We love the old school days. Obviously, it's Retro Gaming Radio. So let's talk about how you got started in development to begin with.
That's going way back. I mean, good grief! I've been programming since I was 12, and that was when I got my Commodore 128. Sadly, I did not start on the Commodore 64. I had the BASIC 7, which was so much easier, and actually, it kind of met me where I was. You know, on the Commodore 64, you're kind of programming in assembly to get stuff on the screen, and the 128, it's like, you know, draw a line, put sprites on the screen. You know, it was perfect for me, and that's kind of where it all started.
You know, that's amazing because I think you're the only person I know that ever actually coded in the native Commodore 128 mode. I mean, we all had Commodore 128s at one point, if nothing else, just for the detachable keyboard. But I think, you know, Go 64 and holding down the Commodore key while powering up was pretty much part of the basic power up process for me, because I don't remember actually doing anything in Commodore 128 mode. But you actually did early development in that, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, when I got my computer, I kind of knew it was coming. And so I went to the Vestal Public Library, and I was just looking for books on programming. And I'm like, hey, they've actually got a book for this 128. And I sat down with graph paper, and I was, you know, geeking out, drawing sprites and graph paper. And I was making programs. I didn't even know how to program. I'm, like, drawing the stuff out on paper, and, you know, and so I got the Commodore 128. I'm like, this is going to be so much fun, and it took me like 3 days just to plug the stupid thing into the television and get it working,
right.
Which was really a bummer because I was ready to just program from day one, but I did eventually just start typing in all the stuff that I made on paper, and it was a lot of fun.
So was that really your very, very first programming experience was the 128?
Yeah, well, you know, on paper, and then, yeah, the 128.
Can you still draw graphics on? Could you actually generate the data statements necessary to create a sprite using graph paper?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I didn't even understand, you know, binary operators or bits and bytes. All I knew is it said do this. Honestly, I typed that stuff in. It didn't work. But I was definitely thinking really, really hard about how to get those sprites on the screen.
Right, so I assume that you probably went through the same cycle as many of us did, typing in code from magazines, right? Compute Magazine or one of the other magazines at the time. And did you also learn from debugging those horrifying program codes that were in the back of the magazines?
Well, you know, I mean, some of my favorite all of my favorite type-in programs were assembly. So, and since I never really got into reading machine language, I didn't learn much from those except, you know, who is the really awesome authors of the type-in games. But there was this one guy from the Ahoy magazines called, his name was Bob Blackmere, and he actually made some stuff for the Commodore 128. And one of the games he made was some kind of orbiting game, and it basically had these asteroids that would just circle around the Earth, and you had to shoot them or something, but it wasn't really that great. Except for the part where, you know, being 12, 13, I had no idea how to calculate. How do you make something go around in a circle? It was just, you know, it was before
right.
I learned trig. I didn't know anything. And so I'm like, holy crap, how do you make something go in a circle? And I looked at that code, that because it was basic, thankfully. And,
right.
And all of a sudden I'm like, sine and cosine. And so I just started cutting and pasting, and that was the beginning of actually being able to program for real. So I'm really thankful for all those type-in magazine games.
I think cut and paste or cut and steal is definitely the early days of any programmer. Yeah, you know, I still don't understand sine and cosine. I've been doing this forever, so I still don't know anything about math. It's terrible. I have to steal or borrow or derive anything I need physics-wise for anything that I develop. So I understand. But I'm glad somebody understands it because then you can help me later when I need the help. So, so let's move forward. When did you get the Amiga bug? Because it seems that most people who start in the Commodore field that move from a 64 or 128 to the Amiga, there was almost a religious calling around it. They saw one at a friend's house. They saw one in the store. Something was a tipping point that made you rush to the Amiga. What was that, if there was one?
You know, that's a funny question because my experience with getting an Amiga was kind of surreal. Basically, I was just talking about this Amiga all day long, and eventually my mom said, "Hey, isn't there like a convention for these computers?" And I'm like, "Yeah, up in Canada." And so, and I mean, honestly, I'm just playing with my Commodore 64. And she's like, you know, I want to take you up there, and we're, you know, I hear you can use these Amigas for like more advanced graphics and stuff like that. And I'm like, sure, Mom, if you want to take me to Canada and we're going to go to the World of Commodore, I'm in. So, so I'm trying to remember. I can't remember if we went to the one in Philadelphia or the one in Toronto, because I think we ended up going to both. But it was the weirdest thing. Again, my parents were divorced, and there was that whole, you know, is the kid getting what he needs sort of thing. But you know, at the time, I thought it was kind of crazy to just be getting an Amiga, because I mean they're very, very expensive. But so as I said, there was no tipping point. I was already very, very interested. I was reading the magazines, and I was a huge Commodore fan. So it was just a random happenstance in my life that I actually came upon an Amiga 2000, and you know, and I just programmed that thing, you know. Just like the Commodore, I was always ready to just like dive into the development.
As a video game developer, you obviously, like any other derivative type of art form, you look at what other people are doing, you look to improve, you look to expand your own ideas through other concepts. What were the early games in the Amiga days? We could talk Commodore 64 and 128 too if you'd like, but what games really left such an impression on you that said, this is why I need to program? Because, I mean, you mentioned the asteroids around the Earth sort of thing, and I could definitely see that being something that would be a trigger. But was there a particular game, either on any of the platforms, that really said, I need to become a programmer because I want to do this?
You know, honestly, one of the things I always did was, my first game console was an Atari 5200, and so I was always really blown away with that particular platform because, I mean, you know, you're 9 years old, and that's, you know, the pixels are burning into your mind, and so my jumping off point, and even on the Amiga, I felt at that point I knew enough about programming to start copying some of the game designs from the 5200. So honestly, I played Joust on the Atari 5200, and I beat it, and I flipped it, and I eventually made a Joust game using Amos, and you know, so that was huge for me. And then there was, of course, the Commodore 64. I was huge into Gyrus, and so, and that's kind of that whole circular thing. And so I've always been, even to this day, I'm still trying to work out some way to make this killer awesome Gyrus game. So those are, you know, Moon Patrol. I on the 5200, I was, I mean, if I've shown you any of my latest stuff on the iOS or Android, if you ping me later, I have this thing that I'm working on that's a prototype platform, and I have a Moon Patrol demo. I made one on the Amiga, and I've made one, and it works really great with the accelerometer and stuff, too. So I've always been really focused on some of that, too. I enjoyed the way the terrain generates and the tires follow it. It's just one of those things that's been stuck in my head forever, so.
Well, that's way cool. I mean, yeah, I get it. I mean, Moon Patrol was actually a fairly, I guess, an aggressive game in terms of those sort of things. They didn't have to make all the tires independently balanced. They didn't have to have that kind of terrain generation, but they went the extra mile. So, if I remember right, the 5200 version was like almost dead onto the arcade, if I remember.
Well, I don't know if it was dead onto the arcade. I think it was maybe better in some respects. But I'm, you know, an Atari 5200 guy, so I'm a little biased. You know, I'd also like to say, too, that I am definitely going to find a way to code something like River Raid, because, man, that game is just awesome. And I've played it on all the different platforms, but, you know, on the Atari 800 or the 5200, it was just an amazing experience. So that one, again, with the random terrain generation, you're 9 years old and you're playing that, and you're like, how did they do that? And, you know, I'm like, what, 38 now, so, and I'm still boggled at how they did that with so few, so little memory. It's just an amazing game.
You know, and that brings up an interesting point. It's something that we've talked about here on Retro Gaming Radio before, but it's kind of nice having somebody in the industry to comment on it as well. To me personally, I think that some of the magic that was involved in the golden age of gaming in the late 70s, the early 80s, wasn't what we look at and we emulate and we give awards for today, which is, you know, orchestral scores and, you know, huge cutscenes and insane graphics, but rather what they managed to push out in such a little bit of resource, such a small amount of resources. I mean, what's the smallest thing that you've ever seen that just blew you away, thinking, how did anybody pull that off?
Oh, good grief. That's a tough question. Interesting.
We ask the hard-hitting questions here at Retro Gaming Radio.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, recently, I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of obsessed with Super Hexagon. I think he did so much with so little, you know, just a driving. But that's a new game. I don't know if that counts for retro. But
sure. I think really the new frontier are these mobile devices, are these tablet devices. Let's be honest, the tablets are getting out of hand. I mean, you've got quad-core processors, you've got all this good stuff going on. It's not exactly a 5200 or a 2600 anymore. But if you look at some of the early mobile days, right, I mean, you're talking about putting out games on, you know, watch-level power in a cell phone.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, honestly, one of the new games I like is called Cannibalt, and I think, you know, most of you have probably heard of it. It was a pretty popular indie game, but, you know, the first time I heard they had that Commodore 64 version, I just, you know, busted out my I have tons and tons of gizmos for the Commodore 64 for getting things on the SD cards and stuff, and, like, I have a 1541 Ultimate 2. You know, so
nice.
So I, you know, immediately pull out like the 1541-2 and put Cannibalt on there, and I'm running at my Commodore 64. I'm like, here, kids, look at this phone. Now look at my awesome Commodore 64 playing the same game. I just live for those moments.
Those are, well, you got a 14-year-old, so that is a difficult time period. Anyway, now remind me, boy or a girl? I forget.
Oh, Maggie, she's 14. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, girls are a little bit different. They got a. They're wired differently anyway, especially at that age. I've raised two past 14, so I know all about it.
Well, sure, but, you know, I mean, both of, you know, all of my kids are obviously, their dad is a game developer, so I think perhaps I generate more enthusiasm for my children than you might be able to with yours. I don't know. It's just I've got them completely, you know, brainwashed. I'm not sure. But it's good. They really like it.
Well, I've got my son playing Game Boy Advance on using a... an 8-bitty controller on his Nexus 7 tablet. So I'm trying to get him to appreciate some of the classics. You know, what's funny. He's got that same sort of black and white, what's the word I'm looking for? He's got a prejudice against black and white, the same as his dad. And I tried really hard not to involve him with some of my, what I would call my shortcomings. And so he loves anything Nintendo IP he's totally crazy about, right? So he loves Kirby, he loves Mario, and I would actually download Virtual Console games for his DS or his 3DS so that he could actually play the original Kirby, the original Mario Brothers. And it's so funny, it's the same game mechanic. I mean, there's nothing different between the two, but he turns his nose up at the black and white games.
Huh.
So it's an interesting, and it wasn't because I influenced him, I don't think. I mean, I never once came down on the black and white thing. But it's interesting that kids can adapt to gaming of any age, but there's always a little recollection somewhere that bothers them. And I don't know where I was going with that. I think I kind of segued out of there. But
oh, you mean like the LCD screens? You mean like the Game & Watch?
No, not quite that far back. I'm talking more like the original Game Boy, Game Boy Color.
The future, you know, thankfully with my son, he's so obsessed with, like, Pokemon right now. He loves all of those things. He loves Pokemon. He loves Beyblades. He loves Bakugan. He goes through these different phases, but when he dives into something, he dives in with both feet. And right now he's dying for the latest Pokemon games, but his heart's desire is to get Pokemon Yellow. For the original Game Boy Color, he wants Pokemon Yellow because that's where Pikachu came in, and he's just so hoping for that for Christmas. So he's in for all the old stuff too. He wants to know everything about it.
That's fantastic. You know, I still have a video or at least a snapshot of my son. I have a main cab set up, so I've got an actual hot rod controller with a roller ball. And that's hard to get is a nice roller controller, and this one's fantastic. I have a shot of him playing Capcom Bowling on Maine with this roller controller when he was like 3.
Nice.
You know, that's like a dad's proudest moment. You know, my son is playing Capcom Bowling, you know, when he's 3 years old. So
yeah, my proudest moment is when I just had Maggie, and I have a picture of it, and I have it on my dresser at home, and it's a picture of her in her little baby seat. You know, those things before they can walk, and she just she's just laying in this baby seat in this really geeky computer room, and in her lap is a copy of Michael Abrash's Zen of Graphics Programming.
That's got to be the best picture ever. You'll have to send me a shot of that. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, as a game programmer, it's one of those things. And all the kids want to have something like that, but it's never been quite the same. And I did take a little flack. My newest daughter, she's only a year old, and we never got a picture of her with some geeky book, but but all the other ones do. It's not quite as epic as
Photoshop's then. For.
Oh, that's a you great know? Idea. I'm going to do that.
Yeah, you know, it's a different world we live in now. So, anyway, let's move back. I know, like I said, we talked about before the show, I knew we would get off kilter at some point. Let's go back to, you got your first Amiga, Amiga 2000. Now, AMOS, which is, it's a dirty word to some people, all right? AMOS was one of those love-hate things, and it's just like, for those of you who may not be Amiga heads, if you've ever seen anything like Click and Create, Click and Play, what are some of the other...
Macromedia Fusion, or something like that?
Yeah, there's a whole series of high-level language development titles. And, of course, the good part about it is it puts development in the hands of just about anybody. Unfortunately, just about anybody also creates really, really horrible games. And with AMOS, I'm afraid that a lot of people got the power to make games but did not have the discipline nor the... innate ability to actually make good games. So AMOS churned out a whole bunch of really crappy games. And so it got kind of a nasty flair to it. It's like, oh, that's an AMOS game. So a couple of commercial titles came out. Legend of Valhalla was, I think, one of the ones that came out that was based on AMOS, and they worked really hard to hide the fact. Thank God there was a dialogue box that came up one time, and I could see the AMOS accept or cancel dialogue box. That's the only way I knew. But AMOS was the language that created your masterpiece, Scorched Tanks, correct?
Yeah, I used AMOS. I used Blitz Basic originally, but it just seemed like this was before Blitz Basic 2 came out, and I saw AMOS. I'm like, I'm going to try this because Blitz Basic was a little crashed. It crashed a lot if you didn't program things right. It was hardcore. And, I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, Blitz Basic was basic. I mean, how hardcore can basic be? But it was. Accept it. But AMOS was a little softer, a little kinder, a little nicer, and actually it was a lot easier to program, too. So I really enjoyed it. It was the tool that I needed at the time. I was not going to learn assembly language. I just was not up to that. But I was quite happy to have access to all the scrolling graphics and all that stuff. It was awesome.
Now, I never got into Blitz Basic. As I recall, now I could be wrong, Blitz Basic felt a lot like C, if I remember right. It felt a little more low-level than AMOS did. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, the same kind of power. I wrote an entire game or two in Blitz Basic. I wrote a game called Zinger in there, and it was really good. You could do lots with it. It's just, as I said, as I matured and I kept reading Amiga magazines, but AMOS was just the next thing to pick up, and so I grabbed that. And the same thing for AMOS Pro. It just kept getting better.
Now, how many extensions, because AMOS had a half a dozen extensions or so that came out. Did you use any of those?
Yeah, though I couldn't tell you what the name of them was. But there was one I had that made it faster for me to render textures. Or no, textures, holy crap. I've been doing too much programming on the iPhone. It lets you draw lines and pixels and read pixels from the screen faster. And that was, you know, that made the terrain falling in Scorched Tank a whole lot faster. It made it possible, really.
Wasn't that the Turbo Plus extension? Wasn't that what that one was?
Yeah, I think so. That sounds about right.
I think I've got the original disc still in my shed. I'll have to go look that up later and see if I still have
them. Yeah, I know. I still have them, yeah. My poor wife.
You still have your original disc, your original AMOS discs?
Yeah. I have my original everything. And I went through this phase in 2005, 2006, where I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start collecting Amigas. So I actually have like all these Amigas and monitors. You know what? Never try to buy an Amiga monitor off eBay, because you buy five and one works. Oh, you know, it's just don't do it. But it's kind of funny, because now I have all these C compilers for my Amiga, and I have all these other things that I'll never program, but it's like, oh, I wish I'd had these, like, you know, 20 years ago.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda, right?
Yeah.
So let's run down. Which Amiga models do you have? Now you got me curious.
Oh, man. Well,
I have an Amiga 500, which I never had. Okay, let's go all the way back. I had an Amiga 2000. Yeah, I had an Amiga 2000 in the beginning, and then I had an Amiga 1200. And from that, I released Scorched Tanks, and then I was able to buy some peripherals. That's all I ever had. But now I have an Amiga 500, Amiga 600, Amiga 1000. You know, not a lot, but it's really fun to use an Amiga 500 because this is what everyone else had. I always had this, like, supercomputer, Amiga 2000. So, but most of the games run better on the 500, so it's kind of fun to be, you know, cool, like Amiga 500 guy.
Now, let's talk Amiga. We're on the topic. Now we're going to segue a little bit. Let's talk Amiga. What sort of hack jobs have you done to your Amigas over the years? I mean, have you done anything extraordinary to your Amigas? I mean, there were so many great hacks out there.
Well, I mean, the moment of truth for me was I had this Amiga 2000, and I thought it was just this magical box that did amazing. I'd never opened it. I had no idea.
Right.
But I knew as time was going on, I really needed to get, you know, the Fatter Agnes chip into that. And so I just ordered one, you know. I'm like, we can mail order that now. And I ordered this chip. And so I'm like, okay, I have to open it. I knew I was going to have to open it. So I opened it. You know, there was no magic fairy dust flying out or anything. I'm like, holy smokes. There's a lot of open space. There's a lot of, yeah, just real dust. And there's just a lot of open space. Like, how does this magical device work? Well, I learned pretty quick because the first thing you had to do is cut some traces. And I'm like, I'm going to take a razor blade to this thing. I was not too sure about that. And I had to, you know, and I did some of the Kickstarter upgrades and stuff too. But that first upgrade to the extended video memory was just like a real shocker. It was epic.
Yeah, I remember doing that in, I think it was my 500. It was something to the effect of using the trapdoor expansion memory. I think you could somehow hardwire that up as chip RAM or something. It was something totally bizarre like that. But yeah, those were the old days when computers still had some sort of a chemistry or
mystique.
A mystique or spirit. I call it kind of a soul, you know. PCs, you know, are just sort of a dime a dozen. You just go buy one and there's nothing special about it. I don't know. Maybe that's just my old geezer nostalgia talking.
I'm with you on that.
It just seems like everything is just so, you know, it's like a computer's a lamp now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need a new lamp, you go buy a new lamp. You need a computer, you go buy a new computer.
Well, you know, I tell you, with the Amiga, I programmed that, and that was just a lot of fun. And when I learned to program the PC, it was like, okay, I got to get a job now, so why don't I get a PC? And so I'm hacking on, I'm learning C and all this stuff, and I'm just, it's just a job for me. I was really great to get graphics on the screen and sound and music. And through the years, as I got into the game industry and things like that, I was just kind of programming it, Get the Windows 95, made VX Ball, just kind of programming it. I'm finally starting to get, you know, DirectX 2 came out. I'm finally starting to get some of that feeling back. Like, you know, this is kind of like programming the Amiga down to the hardware, you know, and you're actually getting some of the magic. But honestly, I know you're not going to. Okay, here's the truth is, when I got my iPhone, that was like, holy crap, this is like on the Amiga again because it was touchscreen and it was accelerometer and it was just a completely new experience. And I know I'm not the only developer to feel that way, but that even, you know, be it the iPhone or the Android, there was something about switching over to these small devices that had that same kind of magic. I just haven't felt that since I cracked open the Amiga.
Yeah, well, I understand that. It's like I said, I think that the it's sort of like having a kid in your 30s or late 30s. It's sort of resetting the clock. You know, you have this magic when you're young and you have a kid, and then when you're like 38 and you have another kid, it's like the whole clock gets reset back again, and you get to re-experience that. And I think the mobile market has really sort of done that. It has the same sort of parameters, right? It's got this kind of a closed architecture. It's got limited resources. You can't just slap another SIM in there if you need a little more memory. You can't put a different video card in there if you want more video memory or you need more pixel shader, bump map, graphic, volumetric light source, thingy-ma-bobbers.
Well, you know, I'll tell you the truth. That back when the iPhone came out, it was the only device, and it had the same resolution and the same memory, and everyone had the same thing. And it was touchscreen, and it had accelerometers and stuff, too. So in that respect, when you're kind of locked into one resolution, one memory footprint, one way of doing sound and graphics, it was that was the magical moment. Now, when I switched over to Android, it's been 3+ years now, and the truth is there's lots of different chipsets, lots of different memory, lots of different resolutions and touchscreens, so that magic is gone. But there was that magical moment when you first switched over to mobile that was just like, you know, every Amiga programmer I knew was thinking the same thing, like, this is fun like it used to be. And so, right. But hey, I got the chops for doing Android now. You know, we've got like 10, 15, I don't know how many Android devices, and our games run great on it. So and so we had to get to that level, but it was kind of fun to get recharged and getting into the mobile market. It's more than just taking advantage of a new way to make money or, you know, something like that. It was yeah, kind of almost a spiritual thing, really. And so we're just kind of propelling with that momentum.
So let's go back to the Amiga 2000. You said that you released Scorched Tanks with your 1200. Tell us about that transition period. Tell us about what started Scorched Tanks. I'm assuming you drew some inspiration from a different artillery game.
Yeah, the classic story. You know, being an Amiga zealot is a funny thing. I live in Endicott, New York. I live near Endicott, New York. Have you ever heard of Endicott, New York?
Only because I'm friends with you.
Okay. Well, here's the truth. If you go back to your history books and take a look, IBM was created in this dinky little Endicott, New York. And this is where I'm from. So to be an Amiga person, to be a Commodore person, where there's IBM, like everywhere you turn, there's an IBM Amiga. There's an IBM here and there. It was like, I have a Commodore, and it's so much cooler than anything else you guys have. But they're like, we don't care because my parents have this $5,000 computer, and it's free, so whatever. Right. You know, it's like, but don't you understand? It doesn't have the graphics. It doesn't have the music. So I was always kind of bumping up against a wall there. So I was like the one Commodore person.
You were part of the early Amiga army. I know. I participated in that army, too. And there's always a new army. There's always a new army to be behind. Now you've got the iOS Android army. You've got the PC Mac army. You've got the Xbox PS3 army. Well, now I've got the Wii U army, which I'm a huge part of now. But that's a whole topic for another discussion. But, yeah, I understand the concept of growing up in an environment. It's so funny because when I was on the submarine, this was back, let's see, what was the date on that one? It's halfway significant. Early 90s, I guess. Let's say that. The best computer on the ship belonged to the electronics division. They were the ones that dealt with all the ciphers and all the codes. And the radioman actually used them. And the best computer that was on the ship, my Amiga 500, totally kicked its butt up one side of the wall and down the other. So I'd have to leave my home to go underway, to go to sea, to protect our country. I would have to leave my beautiful Amiga 500, go to the ship where my division had a CGA monochrome horrifying compact laptop. It was the worst piece of crap on the planet. And it was so crushing to have to leave this gorgeous environment. And then once you got to the ship, you had to sit and complain and whine and talk about how horrible this unit is that you're having to work with when you have the greatest thing on the planet. I know.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's pretty bad. But, you know, one of the things I adopted pretty early is when my parents got remarried, I adopted an IBM PC Junior. And I go, well, you know, it's programmable. Let's take a look. And so I actually dug into that thing, and it was, you know, you gripe about it all the time, but, you know, it had more memory. The graphics were awful, but I was able to, like, you know, I had enough memory to make this really elaborate, like, vector wizardry, this dungeon crawl vector-based game, and I invented vector graphics for myself, because I didn't know that, you know, I didn't really understand any of that, so I made my own vector graphics tools and stuff. Again, things I couldn't have done I could do it on the Amiga, and I could have done it on the Commodore 64, but the PC Junior, it just ground out those really boring tasks of storing lots of data. It was perfect for that. So usually I was just giving people a hard time about how crappy their PCs were. But it, you know, having some PC programming skills was pretty killer in basic class. Everyone else is kind of trying to do something simple, and I'm like, oh yeah, I made the snake game, getting everyone kicked out of the computer lab. You know, hey, you know, I mean, I turned in that Vector Graphics dungeon crawler game to my basic teacher, and I'm like, right. "Just this is my final project." And so I hand him like 30, 40, 50 pages worth of paper, and he's like, "I'm flipping through after he reviewed it." I'm like, "Don't see any marks. Don't see any marks. Don't see any marks." But why do I have a 99? Why don't I have a 100? Well, the answer was, on page like 25 or so, I saw him circle and say, never use GoTo. And that's the best he could do to me.
What?
Never use a GoTo.
Okay, I'm going to share a similar story because there were so many things that rang true at the same exact time. I also took BASIC in high school. This is after I had been coding for forever on my Commodore 64. Let's be honest. The guy that they had teaching the basic class was barely competent enough to even talk computers, let alone teach somebody programming. So I went in there, and his thing, like your guy was GoTo, my guy was flowcharts. Flowcharts, flowchart. You cannot write code without a flowchart. If you do, it sucks. So at the my friend had written the most awesome program on the Commodore 64 called Inquisitor. And Inquisitor was a test generator. He did it for high school testing. And so he could actually it was an awesome deal. I mean, these things are a dime a dozen now, but you could input questions, multiple choice, all this stuff. It would actually give you an exam, grade it, tally it up. It was a fantastic bit of code. And so I took that project and I converted it over to Apple II, which is what we had in the lab. Which wasn't that hard to do. I mean, I had most of the source code and, Apple II and Commodore 64, pretty close. And so I whipped that thing all back together. It was brilliant. In fact, I taught half the class. Let's just be honest here. I'm going to let my ego go unchecked a little bit. He would simply turn the class over to me, and he'd leave and go have lunch early. And I would teach the class in BASIC. So anyway, final project, I turned in the Inquisitor for Apple II. Fantastic program, not a single bug in it. And I also received an A- as my score. And I said, I cannot believe you gave me an A-. One, I taught your whole class for you all this whole time. This code is rock solid. There's not a single bug in it. And this is actually something I think the school used as inside their lab officially for some period of time. And he's like, well, you didn't do a flowchart. I said, I believe that we have answered the iconic question, is a flowchart required for programming? The answer is no. So that's funny that you had a similar story like that.
Yeah, he couldn't touch me. He didn't even probably understand my code. So all he knew is that this amazing like graphical game came up on the screen, and just, I found one GoTo, so I'm humbling this guy.
Man, that's so sucky. GoTos get such a bad rap. But
it makes a great story, though, doesn't it?
It makes a fantastic story. It makes a fantastic story. So let's go back to Scorched Tanks, your inspiration for Scorched Tanks. What was it?
So the inspiration for Scorched Tanks was, as I started earlier, I was this huge Amiga zealot, Commodore zealot. My friends all knew I was an Amiga person. I was the only one I knew, basically. And so I had this one friend who, they accepted me, and I was cool. But one day, my friend Jason was like, Mike, you just have to come over and you have to take a look at this game called Scorched Earth. I know. Your Amiga is awesome, but just do yourself a favor and come try this. And so I went over to his house. I'm like, oh, he's got a Tandy. Who knew Tandy made PCs, for goodness sakes? And I'm thinking all these things. I'm being nice, though. I'm being as nice as I can. And but he brings up Scorched awesome. Earth. And I kid you not, I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. This game is unlike anything I've seen before, and heck, I think I'm going to go program one for the Amiga now because something has happened in the universe, and thank you for the heads up, and I'm going to go fix this. So we played the game like once. I might have played it five times, and that was it.
Really?
I went to my friend's house. I saw Scorched Earth, played it a few times. That was one sitting. That's all I ever saw. And that was enough for me to, go back to my home, sit down with my Amiga, and start cranking out a tech demo on that, and, with the scrolling screens and all that stuff. And I basically, during the development of Scorched Tanks, I'd never seen Scorched Earth again. I'm like, this game was like it had imprinted itself on my mind. I had no idea how to feel about that except to just make it for the Amiga, and I did. And that's part of the reason why Scorched Tanks is I think better. I mean, I wrote it. I'm biased. You can think whatever you like, but I think Scorched Tanks is better because it's got music. It's got cool sound effects. It's got scrolling screens. It's got a cool interface for buying stuff. I just kind of did my best with it. And I used AMOS. You know, I didn't do an assembly. I wasn't that cool. But, you know, I had what was available to me. And it was just kind of a shock because I played Scorched Tanks, and it was really popular. And then when I got to college, I saw Scorched Earth again because they had PCs in the lab at college. And I'm like,
right,
wow, what I made is so much different.
Well, as I recall now, see, I didn't get into the PC until 95. So what year was it that you saw Scorched Earth that first time?
Had to be 92.
Okay. Okay, so you were involved a little more in the PC a few years before I was. For me, it was that stupid magic carpet. That's a
story. Right?
Bullfrog, of course. And that was the first time I said I might have to have a PC now. So,
no doubt. You know, Magic Carpet was pretty neat. I think it had the voxel terrain, didn't it?
It did have the voxel terrain, which just blew me away. That was, I knew I would never code anything like that, but that was sort of the thing that sort of pushed me over the edge and said, hey, maybe we better take another look. But anyway, so I was kind of curious because of Scorched Earth evolved a little bit over time. I saw Scorched Earth again after I'd seen Scorched Tanks. So I'd seen pictures and I'd heard about Scorched Earth, but I had never played it. I played Scorched Tanks first, then saw Scorched Earth later. And I did this big retrospective when I recently reviewed Pocket Tanks. I went back and started looking at some of the old artillery games, where the history kind of came from. And it occurred to me that, you know, Scorched Earth, even through its 3 years. The 3 years from 92 to 95, when I played it, it didn't really evolve much. It was still the same game. I think it went from EGA to VGA. But it was still the same thing. You had 10 tanks on the screen. The screen never scrolled. There was no music. All of the weapons were basic derivatives of the same weapon. There were like 3 weapon types. And it never really went anywhere. And I never understood how having a template like Scorched Tanks, which was incredibly popular, but we'll talk about that in a minute, why Scorched Earth never really evolved.
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to contact Wendell Hicken and ask that question. But honestly, I haven't spoken to him, but it seems to me like Scorched Earth would have been perfect for keeping working on it. But, you know, I think some people just like to write a game and then finish it. But, you know, gosh, when you're a college kid and you're scraping away working at restaurants and trying to, you know, do your grades and stuff, when people start sending you checks for your shareware game, you know, you're going to keep working on it. Maybe it was the case where he was like working for a big company or something and he only had so much time. But at that critical phase in my life when I was like, you know, if somebody's going to send me money to do something, I'm going to work like 5 times harder. So I've always had that spirit of taking, you know, people's constant interest and what I'm working on, and just keep making more stuff. I mean, that's why even to this day, you know, you take Scorched Tanks, you go to Pocket Tanks, and now I've been working on Pocket Tanks for, you know, 10, 11 years. And we're you know, only about 5 weapons short of 300 weapons. You know, we've been working on this. And now we have Pocket Tanks and all these different platforms. Every time we make weapons, it's on new platforms. And I just want to keep working on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's that comfortable glove, if nothing else. I mean, you know the insides and outs. You're not struggling with anything. Now you're actually – it's kind of rare, too, from a development standpoint, that you have an open-ended process for continuing to expand the game without actually having to change the game. I mean, you do have to obviously change code to add new weapon types, but you're kind of in the expansion mode now where everything's tight. You've optimized the crap out of everything. You can't make the dirt fall any smoother or any better, and now you get to play. Now you get to sit there and think, how can I blow that other guy up even better? What a great job you have!
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to make the weapons. You know, we sit around the table. Well, now that I have more people helping me out, we'll sit around the table and we'll discuss all these crazy weapon ideas, and we kind of argue and we get ideas from people on the forums too. So you know, it's neat. It's kind of like Stone Soup. I made this, you know, one game a long time ago. Scorched Tanks, and ever since, there's something about it that just tweaks a neuron in people's minds and just makes them go, you know what, I've really got a cool weapon idea too. So ever since, you know, 93, people have been sending me emails. I really think that there's something about the creation of cool new weapons and tactics and stuff that it's just a, you know, for some people that's just it just inspires them.
Now, Scorched Tanks was, it started off, was it, oh, it wasn't always shareware, right? You had a couple of builds before it went shareware, is that right?
No, it was always shareware, really. It's just, it was .09, you know. You know, I mean, the first time you release something to the public, you're like, what do you call it? Well, I'm not done, right? So you don't want to claim full responsibility for this. We're going to call it something not one.
Now, what was it? Was it $15 for that game originally? For Scorched Tanks?
I think so. I'm not entirely sure.
How can you not know how much your game went for?
Are you serious? That was like 93. I'm pretty sure it was $14.99. I'm pretty sure. But it might have been $15.99. I can't remember.
Okay, forget the actual number. Now, for a period of time, Scorched Tanks was underneath our group, the Dark Unicorn Productions, which a lot of people remember Dark Unicorn Productions solely because of Scorched Tanks, so I have to give you a huge thanks for that.
Oh.
Believe it or not, I mean, I told you the story, right, about being overseas and pulling into England, and we had a couple of shipyard workers come on board the boat that were, you know, natives to England. They weren't Americans that had flown over there to be shipyard workers. They were native English folk, and we had gotten talking about computers, of course, and then the Amiga came up, and this guy turned out to be this huge Amiga fan, and so I told him that I worked, and I wrote some software under the name Dark Unicorn Productions. This guy, one, the guy knew who Dark Unicorn Productions was, which totally blew me away.
Yeah, wow, cool.
You know, now my listeners have to understand, no internet. I mean, this was back in BBS days, for crying out loud. I mean, there was no global connection of people, you know. So the fact that anybody had even heard of that across the pond was huge. But then not only did he know Scorched Tanks and was like his favorite game of all time, which is, of course, a great testament to your programming,
wow.
He also knew about my Psycho Squares game, and he liked Psycho Squares, which was – this was like this huge moment where it's like, oh, my God, we actually have some sort of recognition – as like real developers. I mean, this is insane. I'm in another country, like halfway across the planet, and they know who we are. This is incredible.
Shane, nothing like that has ever happened to me. I mean, the most, I know, it's kind of funny. I walk down the street, you know, I'm just having coffee. I'll go to the bookstore. I'm just a regular guy. I almost never talk to anybody about what I'm doing, though. There was one time when I went into Barnes & Noble holding an Amiga magazine, and they're like, oh, I have an Amiga. I'm like, oh, yeah. Well, I wrote Scorched Tanks. Like, holy smokes. But, I mean, honestly, that never happens. And for you to have gotten on a submarine, gone across the ocean to where they
right.
had all the awesome stuff, over in England and Germany, where the really awesome Amiga stuff came from. No offense to U.S. people, of course. But
yeah, exactly.
To go there, to be, you know, in that environment, and for them to know what you did, that's never happened to me. That's awesome. So, wow.
It's absolutely amazing. It was absolutely incredible. And again, there's really two products that put Dark Unicorn on the map, and it certainly was not Psycho Squares, either one of them. Yours, of course, Scorched Tanks, was huge for promoting our label. But, of course, the full-motion video game, Tomcat. Now, one of the great stories that I like to tell about Tomcat FMV was, first of all, it broke new ground on the Amiga, which was incredible. I love the concept that something I was involved in actually somehow broke new ground in any platform, to be honest with you. And also the fact that that Tomcat made so much money.
Now, really?
So you have no idea how much money Tomcat made.
You sound like you might have made more money than me.
Tomcat was not my game. I made $0 from it. That was John Graham's game. And it was a blatant theft. Forget about inspiration. Blatant theft of Tomcat on Sega CD. I mean, you could hold the two of them up, and I swear to God they used the same assets. Now, he swears to God he did no asset capture from that game. However, he did go to the library and get public domain Navy footage, which I'm assuming is also what the Sega team did when they created Tomcat for Sega Genesis CD. But here's the interesting thing. The last time that I spoke with him about how much money he made on it, he pulled – now, you got to remember, this is, what, mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Again, no internet, BBSs, that was about all you had. He had pulled down some ungodforsaken number, $15,000.
Oh my goodness.
On this shareware game.
Mm-hmm.
Now get this, and then to not be Gauche, I never asked him again how much money he made. He did say, after he made that 10-15 grand on it, he told me later he paid his house off with the proceeds that he made from Tomcat. Now, he's not the kind of guy that would boast or make that crap up. So I have to assume that he actually managed to pay his house off with the proceeds from Tomcat.
That is a much cooler story than mine. I mean, hey, I bought an audio digitizer, and I wasn't paying off my house. I didn't have a house, so that's pretty awesome. Wow, yeah. So Darkstorm Productions did some good stuff.
We did. I mean, it's amazing to think. Now, nothing that I did, of course, but you guys did. So that brings me back to the story. Now that it's like 100,000 years later, I can actually ask you, how much money do you think you pulled from Scorch Tanks over the years?
Oh,
I know you don't have a number. You don't have an account.
Honestly, let's see. I wouldn't think I made any more than, $3,000-$4,000.
Really?
I'm pretty easily motivated. That's a lot of money to a college kid. Jeez.
Well, yeah.
I didn't have to eat ramen anymore or nothing.
It's fantastic. You could actually afford meat. That's too funny. So even the long tail sales, because I know that Scorch Tanks, I'm trying to remember the last time I really saw publicity for Scorch Tanks. It must have been 96-ish that I still was seeing Scorch Tanks discussed, talked about, promoted. Things like that. So if you put it out, 92, 93, that's 3 or 4 years. I would have expected you to pull down a little more than that.
I'm sorry. Honestly. I don't think so.
That's interesting, though. I mean, I'm always curious because, it's something that you and I have talked about recently, which we're going to talk about more shortly, is the concept of what business model works for selling games now. And now you and a whole bunch of other developers, I'm trying not to jump too far ahead here. Have we covered Scorch Tanks enough that I can move forward? Let me think here. Let me look at my notes here. I actually did take some notes. Let's see. Is there any story about developing Scorch Tanks or in dealing with the public or anything like that that you would like to share? Because Scorch Tanks is near and dear to many people's hearts, including my own, and we all like those backstories.
Well, the story with Scorch Tanks was, obviously, after that first experience with being shown a PC that actually had a good game on it, which was Scorched Earth, I went and I made a tech demo of the game, and, I wasn't planning on releasing it, but I had one Amiga friend in the area, and he came over, and he's like, "You have to finish this." I'm like, okay, I've never finished a game before, so let alone publish it. But he's like, "You have to finish this. This game is awesome." So I actually, finished that in 3 months over summer break. And so, if it wasn't for my PC friend who's trying to encourage me to, open my mind, and then the Amiga people are like, "Holy smokes, you got to finish this." So there was a lot of people that was helping me out back then to make sure that I did the right thing, and, it was totally awesome. And as far as when we actually released the game, it was the strangest thing just getting all these letters from all over the world. And, I have somewhere in my basement, I have these big posters of, the United States and the world that have little orange dots all over them that basically show every time a letter would come in, I would, find the address and I'd look it up in an atlas and I'd put it on the map. And so it was always neat, it was kind of neat to see how what I had made had spread across the country and around the world. And it always impressed me that, what I've done is actually, reaching people. And I could give you lots of stories even further into the future, but it was really neat. This one guy actually sent me a caricature of somebody playing Scorch Tanks, and this guy's just sitting at his Amiga, and he's flying back away from the computer in his chair going, "Holy smokes," because a missile had just popped out of the screen and was about to blow him up. So,
I might have seen that.
It is really, really neat when you make something that inspires people to create stuff. And things like that, just they don't happen quite the same these days because the world's a little smaller than it used to be. But back then, when something like that would come, that was just inspiring for me, too.
One of the more interesting things that I've noticed once you kind of breached the world, back in the early days, again, the internet now, you could be chatting with somebody and they could be 8,000 miles away and it's like you're right there. It's not the same thing. But in the early days, I noticed that you really paid attention to where people were or who they were when they were involved somehow with what you created. And I remember being curious about, who's playing the game, who's playing my game, who's listening to my radio show, And who are they? I want to know where they were. I want to know what they did for a living. All of these things I became curious about, and I never had a cool map, and I didn't even know what an atlas was. So, I mean, who even knows what an atlas is? I got Google Maps.
back before Google Maps, we had these right, big paper books that had addresses in them, yes. They were called atlases.
God, it makes me feel so old sometimes.
I had a big, huge one, yeah.
But I found it interesting that the diversity, I mean, it's a given now. It's a given now that if you write something and put it out there, it's going to be viewed by anybody and anybody from anywhere.
Well,
I mean, there's no restriction to that.
Yeah, it's just like on the Amiga. It was the weirdest thing when you start getting these really interesting people that contact you. And on the Amiga, I had one letter I'd opened, this guy had purchased it, but he put it on the letterhead of the company that he worked for, and it was Entertainment Tonight, and I'm like, holy crap. Somebody who works for a television show I've heard of is buying my game and saying thanks. So, I mean, and I have other stories. Like, I have an email or two from Pixar, but I don't want to go into details right now. But it's just, you look at certain things and go, wait, Pixar? So, and you kind of look at the credits of the movies, and it's just, yeah, it's really surreal. You know, who's playing your game? It's pretty exciting. I know I've had people from Stardock say, yeah, Stardock makes great games, like, you know, Sins of the Solar Empire. And they're like, yeah, we play Pocket Takes all the time at the office. And I'm like, wow, holy smokes. You know, I just worked for a little tiny game company. I wasn't making, like, big, awesome games and stuff. And so it's those affirming moments when you realize that the people are really noticing what you're doing at a different level. And today it's kind of funny because, you know, on the iPhone or these other, well, actually even more so on Android, one of the things we're noticing is that we're selling a lot of copies of Pocket Tanks in Russia and other parts of the world, and copies in India. And it's I remember the first time, you know, a long time ago, when I got an order from someplace that wasn't, you know, like Australia or the UK, or, you know, you'd get something really weird like, you know, Singapore, you know, I mean, one of those every now and then. But nowadays, you know, what you make is seen all over the world, and it's humbling.
Yeah, I think that's part of what's missing today. I mean, I don't want to go into old geezer mode, but I think that there's it's almost an entitlement thing today where it doesn't matter. Person X bought your game, so it means nothing. I mean, it's just another number in the column and another buck in your pocket. And there, I mean, if it came from, you know, Abu Dhabi, it wouldn't make any difference to you. It wouldn't even faze you that somebody in Abu Dhabi is actually playing your game.
I totally would be. If I got an order from Abu Dhabi, I'm going to ask and find out if they have one, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know, I like Garfield. And Garfield always sends Nirmal to Abu Dhabi.
Abu Dhabi, right? That's exactly how I knew Abu Dhabi. That's so crazy.
So when my kids were, of course, you know, young, and they were frustrating me, I would tell them, you know, oh, well, I'm not your dad, and your mom's not your mom. We're gonna ship you off to Abu Dhabi, and you're gonna have a new mom and a new dad, and we'd kind of play on that. So, you know, you stuff the kid in the box, pretend to tape it up, and carry it around the house for a while, set him down. Like, you're in Abu Dhabi now, let's pretend. So
that is so funny.
So I would absolutely love to get an order from Abu Dhabi. I think that would just make my week.
That is priceless, because that's how I learned about Abu Dhabi. You know, until I was like, probably in my late teens, I had no idea where Abu Dhabi was, what it was. All I know is that Garfield was always sending Odie to Abu Dhabi. That's so weird. It's a small world, isn't it? It really is, especially with game developers. Anyway, the diversity, I think what was interesting, just to finish that little thread up of my thought process, is that we were some of the first people to really experience the ubiquity of world consciousness. Fighting a cold, so sorry about that. If I have to slur my words, I've got huge pools of snoring down the back of my nose, which I know you needed to know that, TMI, but as my kids would say. But, you know, I found out one time that my radio show, Retro Gaming Radio, the one you're listening to right now, back in its early days when it first came out in the late 90s, was that I had everybody listening to this show. I had a Catholic priest that listened to my show. I had nuns listening to the show. I had people that's like, who's listening to my show? There was no age group that listened to the show. It ranged everywhere from a 9-year-old all the way up to like a 60-year-old guy. And I found out that crackheads listened to my show. That was very inspiring. This guy wrote to me and basically said, you know, between his hits of crack, he listened to my show. And I'm like, am I to be, you know, should I like this? Is this good for me to have this kind of diversity?
It is, kind
of. But it's crazy. It's like who is touching my stuff?
Yeah. Well, you know,
Chris, down the crack pipe.
We are a very, very small developer. So, like, we just released on Android for Pocket Tanks, and all of us, you know, every day, the guys will be like, we've got 1,000 more installs today, and we've got like 5 more orders from here. And because Google is just so open with who purchases your stuff, unlike Apple, I actually know, you know, who's ordering stuff, and I know where they're ordering from. And it's like, you know, so I can tell you now that people are ordering it in Russia and stuff, and it's really, really cool. But we're a small developer, and we don't get a lot of orders every day, and every single order that comes in is just like, you know, back when I started in 2001. And, you know, you're getting 10 orders a day, 15 orders a day. Maybe is this enough to, you know, quit my job? And, you know, well, I'd quit my job, but I'm like, thank God I'm getting 15 orders a day. You know, and it's kind of like the same thing with Android now. We're just getting a few, and we're just kind of getting it going. And every single person that orders our game is just like, wow, we love you. We thank you so much for ordering it. And it's those early days, and it's personal again. So I'm thankful for that.
So you moved from Scorched Tanks. You got the inspiration from Scorched Earth, and you started looking at PCs. And your first big PC title wasn't Scorched Tanks or Pocket Tanks, but rather a very pleasant, addicting to my wife game called DXBall.
Yeah, it was a breakout game, actually. And the inspiration for making DXBall was, first of all, I was working in the game industry, so I had all the reason in the world to be looking at DirectX for my job. I mean, we programmed in boring stuff like WinGee, but I'm like, I'm going to, you know, because my job, you know, I learned about DirectX too, so I was kind of on the cutting edge there. But, you know, I was a huge Megaball AGA fan. And I actually went and I met Ed and Al Mackey, and those guys are awesome. And I still get a chance to talk to them every now and then. But, you know, I'm like, what am I going to make with DirectX? What am I going to make with DirectX? I've got lots of free time. I, you know, didn't have kids or anything like that. And I was just newly married, so I had some time. And what am I going to make? And like, okay, I'm married now. Why don't I make something that my wife likes? So I thought, she loved Megaball AGA, so I took my after-hours programming, because I programmed during the day and I program at night, and I made a DXBall. And it was, you know, I'm like, I talked to Ed and Al, I'm like, guys, I basically made Megaball for the PC, you know, so I put this little thing on the screen that says based on Megaball by Ed and Al Mackey, and that's why it has that on DXBall. But, yeah, I was like, I'm just making this for my wife. I didn't release it. I didn't sell it. It was just totally freeware. And, you know, as I said, I worked in the industry, so I didn't really want to be bothered with the money part or all those mysterious things. So again, it was just in the spirit of just making something cool for my wife that was Amiga-like. And oddly enough, you know, I just released it, just like I did before with Scorched Tanks, and I'm getting like 60 emails a day because I had the foresight this time with just a smidgen more experience. Like, it's just in the off chance it's going to be popular. Put my name in there, and if you email me, I will tell you how to unlock the board editor. You know, just one in a million people are actually going to play this. Probably not. And so I'm getting like 60 emails a day, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's taking me like hours to respond to all these people, and it was pretty surreal. So yeah, the X-Ball was a big game. I didn't make any money, but wow, I mean, just people thought it was awesome, and it opened doors too. So.
So how did you know your wife liked? Did she play Megaball? Was that something that she had enjoyed?
Well, you know how it is before you're married. Your wife tries to, you know, like the things that you like. So I would invite her over. You know, she didn't want to play any of those shooting games or anything. I was like, hey, today I think I got one you're going to like. And she really liked Megaball because it was, you know, had really great graphics and it had really nice music and it was accessible. So that
right.
was the one that she's like, I'm like, hey, honey, you want to play some video games? She's like, well... You know, okay, Megaball. So that was, you know, and she really likes that game.
So did she end up, was she a big DXBall fan, or had she, or, you know, did you make it for her, and then, you know, once she knew it was for her, she didn't play it?
Oh, cut straight to the heart. You know, the truth is, she loves Megaball, is that? I mean, okay, let me bring it into the future for you, okay? Because I was working 60, 80 hours a week as a game developer. I'm sure she was just like, you know, when do we get to go back home? Because I dragged her out to Chicago. You know, it's not like she sits there and plays my game all day. I'm sorry. The truth is, I made this game for her. She enjoyed it. But, you know, let's be honest. There were other things that she wanted to do, too. But moving forward, my kids play Super DX Ball, and it's kind of funny because I've got a bunch of kids now. So when I had Maggie, you know, DX Ball came out, Super DX Ball came out, which is in the future. But, you know, her and her cousin, which were about the same age, they were like, you know, 6 or 7. They're like, Daddy, Daddy, can I have access to the board editor? I want to make boards for this game. And I mean, how cool is that? And so
that is way cool.
So my game came out, and my daughter and my nephews are like, I want to make boards for you. And I'm like, you know, so that's really cool. And so they actually played the game and enjoyed it as well. But then my son Zach came along, and Zach grew up, you know, basically, you know, he was like 3 at the time. He grew up with Super DX Ball, and there weren't a whole lot of games installed on the computer. So he discovered Super DX Ball, and he's like, I play in this game, and I really love this game, you know. And like, my dad made this game, and it's like one of the games that he played in, and every now and then he'll boot it up and play it still. But if you now I have Andy, and now he's 3 years old, and it's the same situation for him. You know, Super DX Ball is still on the computer, and he's like, every now and then I get these stories, you know, I'll come in and be like, Dad, I'm just playing Super DX Ball. I love this game. And it's like, I don't even know how much he realizes that how unusual it is to have a parent that makes video games. But he's like, I love this game. This game is great. And my wife, Sarah, is like, oh, you know, he plays this game all the time and really loves it. And so now that I have Katie, and she's only 1, I'm waiting a couple more years, and we're just going to plant that Super DX Ball, because it's been working great for me for a while. And she's going to be like, you know, I'm going to come home. She's like, yeah, I play this really awesome game. It's called Super DX Ball. So I'm still hoping. But my kids all love Pocket Tanks and Super DX Ball. And I should probably just keep having more kids, because it's really fun to have them grow up and realize that, you know, there's these cool games on the computer and their dad made them. So
that's awesome. Yeah, I'll tell you, DX Ball was my wife's, the bane of her existence, I'll tell you. I mean, my wife is, I think, probably fairly typical in female game players. She's really into hidden object games. She's really into that sort of Myst style, you know, no pressure, walk through the puzzles as you like. You know, I still haven't really cracked the code on making games for women. I still, if somebody said, listen, you know, your life depends on you writing a game, it is appealing to women, I would have a hard time doing it. I don't understand it. But DX Ball was it. I would come in after work, she'd be playing it. I'd come to bed, she'd be playing it. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was just this horrifying addiction for her, and she continued to play it.
And she didn't just play it. Did she just play it because you told her about it, or did she discover it?
I think she looked over my shoulder. I think what it essentially was is you plugged the game to me, and I looked at it, and I was playing it. Because I'll be honest, I'm not a Mega Ball. I was not a Mega Ball fan on the
shame.
So, I know, that's blasphemy. But, you know, and the honest truth is, I think, and this is an interesting side note to the concept of piracy in video gaming. I think piracy is not so much a problem, well, it is a problem, but so much a problem for developers as it is for players. Because quite frankly, once you unlock Pandora's box and you can have access to anything you want, you never play anything. This happened to me on the Dreamcast. As soon as somebody cracked the Dreamcast thing open, I had stacks of games for the Dreamcast, all pirated games, and I never played any of them.
Well, sure, it's fun to collect.
I played it for 2 seconds. It's a collector thing.
Oh yeah, I have like a whole wall of you know, Nintendo DS games out in the hall here. That we call it research. Yeah, we got like a whole bunch of DS
research
games.
Yeah, of course.
I got a wall of Game Boy Advance and DS cartridges. Yeah, yeah.
But the problem is when you are so overwhelmed by that many titles, chances are likely you're going to find one and never play anything else. And for me, like Mega Ball, I was too busy playing Super Frog. I was too busy playing, God, what was the other game I couldn't get my grimy little paws off of on the Amiga? Anything from Team 17 or Psygnosis, pretty much. But so I didn't have time to play anything. You know, I was too busy gathering to actually eat what I was gathering, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's an interesting side note to the situation of, you know, just like the App Store or Google Play, when you have 700,000 things to look at, you know, tons of them free, how do you actually get yourself wedged in there where people see it? But we'll talk about that in a minute. That's all in my other notes for later on.
I can talk about that all day too, yeah.
Right, we're going to talk about that too. But that's why Mega Ball was just never, I had too much other crap to play.
Mega Ball, back on the Amiga, I played Mega Ball AGA, I played Deluxe Galaga,
oh my God,
Rockets, I mean, and yep, that's all I needed to be happy. Those three games
true
was all I ever needed to feel really good about owning an Amiga 1200, actually. So I didn't, after I found those games, I didn't really play anything else. And it's kind of like today. I have access to lots of games, but what do I play? What have I been playing for the past year? Well, I've been playing Minecraft, and I play it with my kids. And do I play other games? Well, no, not really. Do I look on Steam? Well, yes, I do. But every now and then the guys will be talking about a game like FTL, Faster Than Light. That game is just, I play that game till 2 in the morning. I really shouldn't. It is that much fun. And so every now and then, even though I develop games and I'm researching the market, and there's so much to look at, but it's really nice to have just those one or two games that you can play. And the neat thing, too, is when you actually make a game that's doing that to other people, like Pocket Tanks, where they'll play it with their friends and things like that, it's pretty neat, actually. I could just, bang out little games all day long, but to have made one that actually you play more than once is quite the honor. And so I kind of know how that feels a little bit. And so I don't feel so bad when I just play Minecraft all the time. I mean, there's all these great games coming out, but then there's Minecraft, Then there's FTL, and that's good.
Well, before we end the interview, providing we have time, you need to explain Minecraft to me because I don't get it. But let's not talk about that now. I want to get through the other core stuff. Back to the original comment, you sent me DX Ball, which I did like. It was a great game. The wife saw it over my shoulder and she says, "Why isn't that on my computer?"
Really?
And I'm like, "Well, I didn't know you'd be interested." This was early in my marriage,
Yeah.
So, we were still vetting out, She's like, "Well, that looks like fun." So I put it on her computer and never saw her again.
Oh, well, I'm sorry about that, it's kind of funny. It was now Scorched Tanks was one of those games that people just like to play with, against their friends. But DX Ball was the first game I made where people actually played by themselves, and it was kind of creepy because I would get these emails, and it wasn't like, "Oh, your game is great. Let me give you money for Scorched Tanks." It was more like, "Your game is great. Your game is so addictive. It is ruining my life. It is. I'm failing out of college. My wife is leaving me." It was the first time I'd ever gotten that kind of. People loved DX Ball so much, it was ruining their lives, and I had a crisis, because I'm like, I want to help people, I want to make little things, and they're like, my job is over, and I'm it's just. Being a game developer is a big responsibility. You have to balance, the social consciousness of what you do versus, at least, or maybe you don't have to, but I do. I feel it. So for every person that plays DX Ball and said, "Oh, my marriage came to an end. Your game is so awesome." I go, "Well, let's hope there's like 10 people that were like, this game is great and it encouraged me through stuff." And I could actually tell you some really cool stories about, parents had kids that got hurt, used DX Ball to rehabilitate them. And the same thing with
really?
Pocket. Yep, things with Pocket. Like just, right after we released Pocket Tanks for the iPhone, there was this parents that contacted me and they sent me a picture and they said, "Thank you for making Pocket Tanks. Our son had just had heart surgery. You released this game for his iPhone. He was able to play it while he was in bed recovering from heart surgery, and he's getting better. Thank you." And they sent me a picture, and I'm like, holy smokes. So, so I'm sorry for all the people that had to drop out of college because of DX Ball, but there have been some amazing positives, too. So we're making the world a better place. Use DX Ball however you see fit.
Maybe some of his crappy listeners didn't have time for crack because of DX Ball or something.
Oh, that's true. Maybe DX Ball was keeping people from using crack. Who knows? Because it's more addictive.
Maybe so. if you can trade one addiction for another, I would say that DX Ball would probably be better than crack cocaine. But,
I guess
I've never had crack cocaine, so how do I know?
I don't know.
Maybe it's better.
I
don't know.
Well, that's just it. People say it's addictive, I don't know. I like chocolate.
I wouldn't know.
I'm big into chocolate.
Me too.
I'm huge into bubble tea.
Chewy candy, that's for me. Anything that's a chewy candy, it's my favorite.
If DX Ball can keep you from eating chewy candy, then I have succeeded.
You've done your job.
So consider it. Consider it.
Well, look at it this way. The problem with DX Ball is it only requires one hand. So the other hand can be in a potato chip bag. The other hand can be... Okay, don't look at me like that. For my listeners,
I
you can't see
me. We're looking at you like that.
Yeah, I see exactly what's going on over there, what you guys are talking about with one hand. This is a family show. If you want to come on Passenger Seat Radio, we can get into the depths of
humanity. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, of course you don't. For those of you who are listening that don't have the benefit of the Skype video I'm seeing of Michael over there, when I said something you could do with one hand, you should have seen him.
Yeah,
anyway.
Looking off screen, Feel free to cut if you like, All right. Yeah.
All right. So we'll get right.
We're moving on with how many hands it takes to use to play video games, right? Yeah.
So have you ever regretted, now be honest, have you ever regretted not monetizing the X-Ball?
No.
Really?
I've always been very happy.
Once?
No, I've been very happy. I think the freedom of just releasing a free game and just knowing that people like your game and it's completely free, I don't know. That's just really positive. I don't feel bad about that at all. Anytime you make something that people play your game more than once, you know, is just a shock to the system. I figured at that phase of my life, I'd made Scorch Tanks. I was in college. I had lots of energy and enthusiasm. You know, I got into the game industry. Am I ever going to make another game that's successful? These are the questions you ask yourself as you get older. Am I ever going to make another game that's successful? So when DX Ball came out, I'm like, oh, people still like what I do. It was very encouraging, and I've never regretted that. I mean, there was DX Ball 2, and there was Super DX Ball, and obviously you take those things and you make money from them, and that's encouraging in a different way. But no, DX Ball being free is just, I don't, it's not always about making money for me. It's about making awesome things, and that's that you know, goes straight to the heart, you know, and that's why I do this. It's not about business so much as it is I feel a need to make games, and it's really neat when people like them, and I'm going to continue to do that, you know, no matter what's happening. As I've always told myself that too, you know, feast or famine. You know, if I'm working for someone else, or I'm working for myself, I'm always going to be making something, and that's just part of who I am. So free or not, you know, hey, if I have to make free games, I'm still going to make free games. If I can never make another published game, then I'm going to make free games, and so. Yeah, that's just part of my core beliefs.
And it's, I must say, it's rather rare, I think. Now we have a circle of people that what was kind of the ring of independent game developers that you and Boa and some of the other people were involved in? You guys had almost like a ring of shareware game developers at one point in time that you guys kind of cross promoted and. Did you guys ever actually have an official name for that, or did you guys just...
No, actually, you know, Mike Bay and I are just friends from the Amiga days. He's actually, you know, I mean, the story with that is he was, he'd made this game called Artillerist, and I had been working on Scorch Tanks, and he didn't know who I was. I was some punk. And so I'm like, I saw his game, like, released in a magazine or something, like, oh, somebody made a game like Scorched Earth. Oh, I guess I'll just finish this game, and I'll just finish Scorch Tanks, and oh, it's just like, I can't believe it. Oh, I'm just so... humbled, and it's like I wasn't fast enough, and I was so bummed out. And so what do I do? Because Scorch Tanks isn't done yet. What do I do? I'm like, all right, I concede. I am going to send him, you know, a $15, you know, shareware donation. And so I'm like, I write him this letter. Dude, great game. Here's some money. Send me the registered version, please. You're awesome. I was working on a game. No big deal. Thanks for your time, you know. So,
for crushing my dreams.
Yeah, so I sent this letter out, and nothing ever comes back. No response.
But
the story isn't over, obviously, because then I released Scorched Tanks. And then, after a few months, I get this letter in the mail. I go, holy smokes, hey, nice to meet you. So, and from there, we've had this awesome dialogue. You know, him and I are still making games and stuff. But we did kind of have, you know, we shared some banners on our website. And he's, you know, he's worked for PopCap, and he's working some, he's making games. We're, both of us are still doing the same sorts of things. We're making games and making it our living. And even, you know, from the Amiga days till now, we're still doing that sort of thing. It's just cool to have other people that you can talk to and that kind of know where you're from and doing the same stuff. And there's no official thing. We're just really good friends, and we do the same sort of stuff. And, yeah, it's really, really glad that I humbled myself and said, oh, you wrote the game first, and oh, I made this game, and no big deal.
Thank you so much. Did he buy your game? Did he, with that letter, did he have a check in there for the registered version of Scorch Tanks?
I don't remember. All I remember is he responded, and I'm like, holy smokes, another programmer is talking to me. You know, sometimes you feel like the only programmer in the world, you know. It's like, holy smokes, he responded. We're so talking. And then he ended up getting me the job in the game industry stuff, too. So it was like, you know, it was awesome.
That's so funny.
And so now he's making Rune Raiders, and I'm working on Pocket Tanks and some new games and stuff, too. So we're still at it. We're keeping each other. We're like, you know, iron, you know, sharpens iron.
Right. So when did Blitwise come into the picture? So DX Ball obviously ruined marriages and kept people from doing crack, but when did Blitwise actually come around?
That was in 2001, actually. One of the things happened after being in the game industry was, you know, my wife wanted to come home to upstate New York where we could have a family. And so I kind of had to, like, decide to move from, you know, the big city, you know, from Chicago back to home. And so I worked at Lockheed Martin, and I had a really, really good job there. You know, I managed to find myself in the elite hacker division, where it was respected, you know, if you could, like, you know, code and optimize. It was a really, really neat kind of, like, almost, it wasn't really like a Skunk Works, but it was like a safe place to be, like, a cool programmer. And I landed in this, you know, this really awesome part of Lockheed Martin in Owego. And so I had this really great job, but, you know, I've always had this, like, DXball 2, Scorch Tanks. People keep contacting me and saying, you know, hey, when are you going to make your next game? You know, and talk about the pressure. I'm like, yeah. I'm trying to kick this. I'm trying to grow up. I'm married. I have a kid. I'm trying to, you know, do the whole, I have health insurance. I have a 401k. Right. I have a house. People are still like, when's your next game? I'm like, you know, and that eats away at you for a while. It's like, and you kind of get to this point where you're like, I think I'm going to entertain making my own company because I'm not quite sure how else I can keep the house, you know, and all those things. And so there's an affirmation. People are still they're hunting me down and asking me when. People at work, hey, you're really good at this. If you consider making more, I mean, it's, you know, talk about pressure. So it came to be that I just decided to make Blitwise Productions. I thought that was a clever name. You know, there's Bitwise Operators. And there's blitting with graphics. I, you know, kind of put it together. And, you know, there's Blitwise. It's kind of super, super geeky. But the thing is I had to make games because every day people were asking me, what's your next game? You've got, like, all these great games. You've got to make some games. And so I decided to just quit my job after, you know, hearing some of my friends who were, you know, making some money in the downloadable game thing. And of course, there was DXball 2, which was successful with Longbow Digital Arts. I had just enough of a hint that perhaps maybe I could do this. And so that's where Blitwise came to be. I had grown all up. I had got this awesome job. I was respected. I was, you know, I was doing awesome. I was, you know, the sky was the limit with my career. But nonetheless, somehow I was called to develop games. And so I've been doing Blitwise ever since. It's been 11 years now.
Wow. And how many people do you have working with you?
Well, that's a funny question. You know, obviously I did you know, Blitwise by myself until about 2005. And then we hired a few folks, you know, programmers and people to help you with tech support. You know, the basic things when you're really tired of, like, doing everything yourself. And it's nice to have some people to back you up with newsletters. Nice to have people, you know, back you up with tech support and some programming. And that really just kind of opened the door for me getting my game into new platforms, like on the Mac. And, you know, it wasn't until the team came on that I was actually able to start doing newsletters and promoting my products or something like that. It became a process that we could repeat easily. And so we had, like, two or three people back in 2005 and 2006. But obviously 2008 hit with the economic, you know, recession. And that brought Blitwise all the way to its knees. Unfortunately, I had to let a lot of people go to, you know, I just didn't have hours to give them anymore. And I'll never forget the time, you know, because it was just Ben and I. We were packing up the offices because I just didn't have the money to continue. And we were just sitting there eating Chinese food and going, you know, this was really, really great working here. You know, so in 2008, we were still kind of working on the iPhone version of the game, but we ran out of money. And so we're just kind of like going, well, this was great. This is a great run. Let's just take it into your house and, you know, we'll just give it a one final push sort of a thing. Because we didn't give up. We just totally ran out of money. And so we packed up and we moved into my living room. You know, and so I got this guy who's got a really loud muffler because, you know, he's in college. And, you know, we always knew when he was coming in, he'd come in the front door and he'd hang out in our living room. And we had all these desks set up. And, you know, I'm kind of having new kids. You know, Andy was just born. And, you know, so you got people working in the house. And for anyone who's ever had a small business, who's ever, you know, had people working out of their house, it's not an uncommon thing. But it's definitely different when your business is your house, is your business. But
right.
Somehow, you know, we finished this Pocket Tanks for the iPhone. And it took off. And so we're like, oh, what do you do? So all of a sudden, you know, this game is getting all these downloads and all these purchases, and we're just kind of sitting in the living room and being like, well, what do you do? And so you kind of sit on that for a year because you're like, well, okay, so now we have money now, but I remember what it was like when we were closing the office and we had to let everyone go. I know what that feels like, and it's hard. And so to make the decision to get out there and to get a new office and then, you know, bring everybody on and then some, and kind of to where we are now, where we can actually release Pocket Tanks for Android, and it's owning your own business is quite an experience. We've been through so much, and it as neat as it is to have everyone here, I know what it's like to be by yourself, and I know what it's like to bring people on and be brought to your knees, and then I know what it's like when things just work out, like, you know, the way they are right now, and it's exciting, and it's hard, and it's not for everyone, I'll give you that much, but that's what we're doing right now, so thankfully you and I can talk right now about how cool it is that people are still playing Pocket Tanks for 11 years, and we've got some new games coming out, like we're going to be making a new version of Scorch Tanks and stuff, too, and some more games, too. We've set up the situation where we can actually, like, we'll be able to make, like, maybe a couple of games in 2013, you know, that we've finally got it all figured out. So it's just wow, you know, start your own company, then you'll learn lots of neat stuff.
You know, I think I might take a pass on that, because while you were talking about, you know, having to close down and sending everybody home, I started getting an ulcer. So if I can't handle listening to it happening, I don't think I could actually do it myself. So I have a bunch of friends that are in their own business scenario, and yeah, the guy that wrote Inquisitor on the Commodore 64 that I ported to Apple II, he's a real estate guy, Troy Tulu, and he went through the same deal in the late 2000s, and he would call me, and he'd be telling me these stories, and I'd be going, dude, how are you not committed at this point? I mean, how are you not in the insane asylum? How are you not treating, you know, a bleeding stomach ulcer? Because I don't know how you do it. It's like, well, you know, don't forget to eat this week. It's like, oh, great.
Well, you know, I mean,
what do I do with that?
here's the truth. I mean, speaking from the heart, I believe in a higher power. And so for me, I always believe that what I'm doing is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm not driven necessarily by profit. I'm driven by, you know, people like my work, and I feel like I'm doing, you know, what I'm supposed to be doing, and therefore I continue, even though I think a lot of people probably would struggle to make the same decisions that I do, because I know that I'm doing the right thing, and I want the world to be a better place, and you just gotta go with that. Don't be afraid. I mean, of course, it's one thing to say it, and it's another thing to do it. I'm doing it, but, yeah. You know, it's important to...
So tell me about, what does Blitwise offer at this point? Now, you're developing for PC, Mac, iOS and Android. Is there a platform that I'm missing in there?
No, actually, you're right. We've been doing PC since the very beginning. We picked up Mac in like 2007. Android, for the iOS, we released that in 2009, I believe. And so now we're on Android, 2012. So, well, actually, these are strange times, because we're still supporting our PC and Mac builds. But honestly, these new app stores that we're having for, like, well, obviously Apple kind of started it, you know, kicked it off, the ones that actually worked with in-app purchases and all that. Now you have Android, and how many different stores do you have on there? And we're looking at, you know, supporting a few more stores. And now we've got, you know, for Microsoft and Windows, there's the Windows Store for Windows 8. And so we're porting to that, too. And again, that's one of those curated environments, you know, because the PC and Mac that we have right now is just kind of like the Wild West. You just install it. I mean, obviously our stuff is good, but people are kind of used to being in these, you know, these walled gardens. And so we have to kind of make our games for each of the gardens that people like to hang out on. You know, so for iOS and for Google Play and for Windows, and we have to get our game in the Mac App Store, and we're looking at Steam. I mean, these are things that are coming up for this year. But right now we're only in two. You know, we're in the Apple Store, and, you know, for the iPhones and stuff, and then we're in the Android for Google Play and all your awesome Android devices, and I'm really impressed with some of the quality for the Android devices that are coming out these days. I remember when we first started developing for Android, I'm like, I do not want to develop for this platform, but it was...
I remember those.
It was
I was begging you.
Well, I know, but I'm like, no, this technology is not ready. I feel sorry for all you poor Android developers. This is the year to be developing for Android. If you've not jumped from iPhone to Android, at least technically, it can be a lot of fun now. So that's pretty cool. But we're looking at Windows 8, because now there's the Surface that came out, and that's going to have an App Store. And, you know, right. So yeah, I mean, that's right now we're moving into more of these App Store environments, and it's cool because you can update the product and it automatically gets onto the person's device.
excuse me, it gets onto the person's device, which is really cool. And when you release new weapon packs, they just automatically know. I mean, it's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a far cry from uploading Scorched Tanks to a BBS and hoping to God it gets somewhere, huh?
Well, I think for a lot of people it is kind of that way anyways. I mean, how many applications are out there that people have only... I mean, I have some friends that I'm afraid they'll release a game and they've got like 5 downloads ever. I mean, that's just heart-wrenching. Right. So, and that's not necessarily our experience, but, you know, it's like being alone in a crowd, okay? At least back in the good old days on the BBS, you knew... You were one of very few that were ever going to check this out. But nowadays,
right.
You could make this application and still nobody will play it. Is that better or worse? You tell me.
You know, I don't know. And, you know, it's funny because there was a point where I think it was 2001. I got to lose all my jobs, too. And there was a point in time where I had about a 6-month hiatus of working where I said, hey, Michael's doing it. There's a bunch of other people that are doing it. I think maybe I could do it. Maybe I could become an independent game developer as well. And my parents actually financed the project.
Oh, lucky.
Which I know, right? let me rephrase that. Let me rephrase what financing the project means. They paid my bills so I could concentrate on writing VS Ball.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I made, you know, next to nothing on VS Ball. It didn't work out. But I didn't give up. You know, I came out with a couple other things, too. But, you know, it just didn't work out, and I went back to working for the man. And I look at that process where it's like, you know, I don't know how you can be successful today with the – I've been saying for years that there's a game crash coming, much like 1983, where the market is so flooded with product that there's simply no way to stand out heads or shoulders above and actually first create a name for yourself. You know, there were certain companies like Imagic on the 2600, Psygnosis on the Amiga, Team 17, where essentially you just bought their product sight unseen. You say, oh, Imagic's got a new game out, and you go and you buy it. Don't care anything about the reviews or anything else. You knew when it came out, you had to have it. That simple. But how do you do that today? How is a game developer now? How are you dealing with this unbelievable dearth of product? How are you dealing with that?
Me personally?
Yeah, how's Blitwise dealing with it?
Well, there's what I've always done, which people don't understand, and that is I make what I like, and it just works out. But that blows certain developers' minds. I think on more than one occasion I'll talk to people, and they'll be like, I think I figured out your system. I think if you do this, and you do this, and you do this, and this is why it works for you. And it's kind of interesting to watch other people try to figure it out. You know what? I just throw my hands up in the air, and I just say, I'm just doing what I do, and it just works out. So I don't have any special, you know, magic recipe for this, but I can tell you now, because we're in a situation where we're kind of growing our company and we're learning about, you know, how do you get noticed, and there's a lot you can do, a lot more than what I've done now, which is really just upload my game to download.com and hey, let's just go for it, because that's, if you want to know how I started Pocket Tanks, I just released it to download.com and that was it. You know,
right.
It doesn't make any sense. It just is. And it was the same thing with the X-Ball. I released it to some, like, the Win32, like, website or WinSite or something like that. And there it was. And bam, I don't know how it works. I just make stuff and, you know, you just kind of keep making stuff until it works. Mm-hmm.
Well, it worked back then because, like, in the given – I remember back in those days, the 2Cow days and the WinSite days where, you know, that was sort of a daily ritual. You'd get up in the morning. And, you know, before you went to work, you loaded up those sites, and it's like, here's what was released today, you know. And you could pan through 20 titles in a day and say, oh, that looks interesting, that looks interesting. Now, you know, 20 titles have been released on Android since I just mentioned the word 20 titles
yeah, no kidding.
5 seconds ago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even on iPhone that has this very cultish-type market, even there, you know, you could be buried in 2 seconds, you know. I mean, I don't understand how you're evolving. And maybe that's a corporate secret, and I shouldn't be asking that question anyway. But the truth be told, you know, I was talking to Mike the other day about his Zombies Don't Drive.
Mm-hmm.
Or wait a minute, is that the name of the game?
Yeah, he's got Zombies Don't Drive and Piranha Chase, which are both pretty cool.
Now, see, I haven't even heard of the other one yet.
Well, that's what Zombies Don't Drive is actually like a skinned version of Piranha Chase. They're both the same sort of game, except he thought zombies would really spice it up.
Right. Okay, I got you. So, you know, and I went, and I, just as you said, the thing had 5 downloads, you know. And it's like, well, how can that be? You know, Rune Raiders is a fantastic game. I mean, my son even plays it. He's 6 years old. He plays Rune Raiders.
Well, Felicia he Day plays, it. You know. I mean, she tweeted about playing Rune Raiders. I can't say that. You know, I mean, Rune Raiders.
I finished the whole game. It was fantastic.
Yeah, Rune Raiders has got lots of people playing that game. It's awesome. So,
you know, and then you look at that and say, well, listen, it's, when you have a success like Rune Raiders, which is fantastic, great game, fantastic, everything's great about it. I'm assuming it's selling relatively well. I know he had some malware problems, but I think it's selling. You know, how do you go from that to a 5 download game? It's like, that just doesn't make sense to me. You know, for me personally, I'm watching the companies that I love and seeing what's coming next, but I'm not so sure the general public is doing that.
Well, it's a different market. It's a different market, and I guess at least for me, it's the sort of thing where people know my product and they like what we're doing, and we release stuff, people like it, and they just check it out. They're searching for it. How do you get noticed? I'm not sure, but it's definitely an interesting thing. I know that, you know, when we make the new Scorch Tanks, the people are going to be interested because people like Pocket Tanks and people have heard of Scorch Tanks, and that's the sort of thing where we can tell all the people that have played Pocket Tanks about our game. That's easy. That's simple. Discoverability is been solved. It shouldn't be any problem for me to, you know, continue to do what I'm doing, because I'm very confident that the next artillery game we make is going to be like Pocket Tanks and even more so awesome. So, you know, you can play Pocket Tanks or you can play Scorch Tanks, and Scorch Tanks will be more complicated and Pocket Tanks will be more like eating popcorn, but they both serve their purpose, and they there's going to be anyway, so we're talking about marketing, things like that. How do you release a brand new game? Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to make a game this year, and I'll let you know how it goes. Let's have another interview a year from now, and I'll have that all figured out. I'll tell you how it goes. Yeah.
So, just to round things up, I mean, we won't spend a lot of time on this because, you know, this is Retro Gaming Radio. We spent plenty of time talking about the old stuff. But talking about dealing with the gaming markets now, there's a lot of discussion, at least in the circles that I float around in. Two different things. One being dealing with different environments like stores, right? I did a lot of research. I had to give some Android training at my job, actually, which is unusual. And I had to, because I don't know anything about Apple development. So I actually had to go to their website. I had to dig through all their development stuff, and I had to look through their rules and what they will publish, what they won't publish, And I had a little run-in with Apple and iTunes recently for my podcast, a different podcast that I do. They decided to just drop it and not tell me why.
Oh, man.
It's a horror
story. Yeah, we don't have to get into that.
It's a horror story. And it really upset me, not only the fact that I've lost all my ratings, I lost all my comments, I lost essentially, you know, I probably lost half my listeners. Because, you know, once it disappears from iTunes, they have no idea where to go get it.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, that's... And so I was pissed, and it's like, why? And it's like, well, because we're not going to tell you.
Well, no,
you go figure it out. And, you know, my syndication service actually had to go talk to them on my behalf, and we spent, you know, days going back and forth. Why did you take it down? Why did you take it down? Why did you take it down? And, you know, it turned out to be something stupid. But my point is that working in that kind of walled environment would make me absolutely mental. Now, I know there's a trade-off in the Apple world where you've got a limited number of SKUs, you've got fixed resolutions, you've got all the things that Android's not. How do you feel about the walled environment as a developer, as somebody who's actually selling games, not somebody who's consuming them like me? How do you feel about the difference between the walled garden and the wild, wild west of the Android?
Oh, that's a tough question because we're still pretty new to the Android market. In fact, we haven't even like fully, you know, told everybody that we made Pocket Tanks for Android. So I guess you know, back in the good old days, it was good to just have the one resolution and the one hardware. But right. with Android, you know, people can sideload things, and it's so much easier for me to get people to test my games. So as a developer, it's kind of neat. It's so much easier to just say, would you like to test my game? Just go to this web page, and you can download it straight. So that's actually a huge plus for a developer.
Cause I didn't think about that, but that's true.
I mean, you wouldn't believe how hard it is to set up the different kinds of, like, the builds and the ad hoc builds you have to do, and you can only have 100 people ever test your game or develop your game. And there's some pretty serious limitations for developing on the iPhones. And Android, it's, you know, you can do pretty much anything, and that's good. And that's also kind of scary. But
it is scary, I agree.
It's scary. And plus also, too, with Android, there's every resolution under the sun. I mean, here's a funny thing. We released Pocket Tanks for Android, and we didn't even know they made 4x3 Android devices. And so you know, and it's like, does the game work? Well, of course it does, because the iPad is the same thing, and our code was compensating for that, though we weren't exactly checking. We just coded it correctly, but there are some other less forgiving resolutions that we didn't know that Android came out for, and it's just like, oh crap, you know, because there's just so much to check for. So, okay, it was kind of funny. Okay, we're going to test Pocket Tanks, and somebody give me statistics on the top 5 tablets that are being sold and the top 5 phones that are being sold, and we'll buy them. And then that'll cover what percentage of the market. I mean, but unfortunately, there's still the situations where – so Android has just been a real challenge to test. But, hey, if you look at our reviews, you'll see most everyone gives it 5 stars, which I don't know how that compares to most Android releases, but I think it's rare. Is it, Shane, in your experience in the Google Play Store, what does a 5-star rating look like to you? Do you see many of those on Android?
No, you know, what's really funny is the Android marketplace, and when I say marketplace, I mean people, consumers of Android, they are very, very wishy-washy. You will never see, hardly ever, a product on Android Store where you see a consistent rating. They will go all over the place. And it's probably for the reasons that you brought up legitimately is, well, it doesn't work on my HTC X, so I gave it 1 star. You know. And, you know, they're not interested in contacting the developer. They're not interested in, you know, how they speak in the Android market is, if it doesn't work on my device, it gets a 1 star. And when you fix it, I'll fix my score. So what you usually see with a release, especially with a new company or somebody who's put out their first game, is you'll see a lot of 5 stars and a lot of 1 stars and a couple in between. So if you're regularly seeing 5 stars, then you did the right thing.
Well, it's been just such a blessing because it's hard to imagine it. Again, you look at other people's products and you take a look at the ratings they're getting, and most of our ratings are 5 stars. We got a couple of 4s, and we got a 1 or 2 1s, not really that many. And I think that's really unusual. So it's really, really neat to have made a product that everyone just says 5 stars anyways. So it's pretty much everyone. So it's pretty neat. And I think my experience with Android is different than most developers. People just download my game and people just give it 5 stars. So it's like, I don't know. I guess we'll just keep making more games because it's working for me.
I think there was
that's fantastic. Well, that's good. You know, I recently read something that was rather disturbing. And again, I'm trying not to spend too much time on this. That at this point in time, there's about 25 developers on Android that are actually making any money. Everyone else is, you know, hand-to-mouthing it and not doing well. And the reason being, of course, is that there's a diversity of models on Android. I'm sure this is the same on iOS as well. The free-to-play, the freemium, the what I like to call the Smurfberry syndrome. You can thank Smurf Village for that. And you do not follow that model. You follow old school model.
Yeah, we're pretty.
Can you talk about what caused that?
Well, I follow the shareware ethic. You know, if you build it, they will come. I know that's not necessarily true for most people, but I've always lived by that. And even the other day when I was my wife still believes it too. You know, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I can make another game. And, oh, you know, those things that you do in the middle of the night and you're thinking to yourself, oh, am I doing the right thing? So my wife, to encourage me, and it's not the first time, she says, if you build it, they will come, because it's happened before. So that's right. Pretty much how I deal with it. If you just make it, just believe and do it, and it works out.
So it, your plans at Blitwise is to keep that model, because let's be honest, there's obviously a ton of money to be had with the Smurfberry type marketplace. And actually, if you go and you look at the Google Play Store, I'm sure you've done this or your marketing guy's done it. You go to the Google Play Store and you see top grossing games. There's not a single one of them that costs any money to actually download and play. 50 games, if you go down there, I mean, it was the last time I checked. It may not be now. But if you go there and you look, there's 50 games on that list, top grossing games. Not a single one of them say anything but free.
Well, you know, I tell you what. I mean, okay, so there's 25 people making money on Android, making lots and lots and lots of money. And just like with the iPhone, you know, with developers like me, there was always this thing they called it the gold rush, you know, the iPhone gold rush. And so everyone got into it. And I got into it because it was a natural transition from my PC game. It's not like I was, like, trying to get into some market and make loads of money. That was never my goal. My goal was just, like, I have a responsibility to Pocket Tinks. The fans are asking for it. It's just like when I started Blitwise. The fans are asking for it. Will you please make another game? And so when the iPhone came out, the fans are like, will you please make Pocket Tinks for the iPhone? And the answer is yes. Yes, I will. So, I mean, that's and I do. And so that's my motivation. I was never into the rush. And the same thing right now for making money with free-to-play or freemium or all these fancy marketing terms. Now, these are all things that we'll take a look at, of course. But honestly, at my core, there's the shareware game developer. I'm going to release a game for free. I mean, actually free. And if you respect my work, you know, I'm like that guy out on the street playing my banjo and just, you know, it's just so sweet, you'll cry. You know, it's you know, you're going to put money in my banjo case because it's worth it, because it's good. And that's what drives me. And so no matter how many of those games you see that are, oh, freemium, free to play, and you feel kind of like you're being, you know, marketed. And a lot of people like that sort of thing. But I believe if you do good work and you do the right thing, and you release something, that people are going to actually recognize the quality of what you do. And I don't live in fear of that. I lean into it. We make what's really good, and we make what we feel is the right thing to do. And, you know, and other people can work on their interesting little, you know, things that they do with marketing. And I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing because it works. Because people believe me. When I make a game, they believe that it's going to be good. And I think trust is a huge part of, you know, being a good developer.
I totally agree. And obviously, like you said, it works. And obviously you have my support and the support of my people and anything I can do to help, you know, promote your products or your company or whatever, because I do believe and I do support and I'm passionate about the people that I believe in.
Well, and I believe that that's you know, that's how it's supposed to be. That's why I still make games. People care. And because they care, I care even more. And that's really what you want the world to be like. It doesn't always have to be about, like, you know, all those things that, you know, get rich quick. No, that's, you know, it's like, why did I choose an Amiga over a PC? I would have got a better job if I had gotten a PC. I chose the Amiga because the Amiga is totally awesome. You know, why did I choose a Commodore 64 over, you know, other things? Because the Commodore 64 was awesome. And so my choices have always been go for what's right. You know, choose the right thing. And that works. And you don't have to live in fear of all the, what is everyone else doing? Okay, you pay attention to what other people are doing. But, you know, follow your heart. That's what you got to do. And you don't let, you know, what other people are doing, because, you know, they have different advantages. They have different knowledge. They have different experiences. But, you know, if you do what you think is right. And so that's, yeah, just it's out there and you know it's out there and you're looking for it. And other people are looking for the good stuff, too. And I'm trying to make the good stuff. Hopefully you'll find that my stuff is good and there's other people. You just have to keep poking around. And I've always been about find the stuff that's good. You know, do I play some of the games that are really popular on the iPhone? Well, some of them are pretty good, sure. But a lot of the stuff would never really interest me because I'm looking for what I like. And since the world doesn't make a lot of what I like, I make what I like. So you can always count on me to make what you're not seeing anyplace else. And if you do, I assure you it's better than most. So I have to put a little disclaimer on that one. But generally speaking, I only make what I really love, and it's usually got to be a rare and special thing. So,
well, Michael, you've said it all, and in some cases more than everything. One-handed game playing, for example. But Let's end this with exactly what you have right now available. You have Pocket Tanks on all the major platforms, and I'm assuming you're going to have some sort of a major advertising type push to other Pocket Tanks folks to let them know that it's available on Android, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, we'll get that newsletter out pretty soon to all the fans.
And you said you have some other stuff in the pipeline. Would you like to give us a little sneak peek? What's coming? What can we expect to see from Blitwise?
Well, right now we're actually working on a brand new version of Scorch Tanks. And so, I've been getting that question for a long time. When are you going to make Scorch Tanks? Well, and if I'm one of the people that have emailed me, I say, oh, it's going to be in 2008. Oh, it's going to be in 2009. Oh, it's going to be 2010. I've been saying the Scorch Tanks is out this year for, I mean, when it was 2010, I tell you, I was so going to make Scorch Tanks in 2010. The truth is, we spent all of 2012 getting ready to make Scorch Tanks. So in 2013, we're going to make the new Scorch Tanks, and it's going to be, as far as I'm concerned, the quintessential artillery game experience. It'll be everything that the Amiga people loved, mixed in with everything that people enjoy from Pocket Tanks, mixed in with, well, pretty much I've had, like, you know, tens of thousands of suggestions from fans over the years, and we've got a lot of people here at the office that are, you know, into artillery games, and they've been doing this for almost as long as I have now. So we know how to make a really awesome artillery game. We're going to make the hardcore artillery game, and that's Scorch Tanks, and that's going to be next year. So that's the one thing that's coming up. And, of course, the next thing is, of course, Top Secret. I'm going to be working on some new game prototypes, excuse me. But you know what? I'm not ready to talk about those yet, but we're going to have new games coming out in 2013, and it's going to be exciting.
So the website, blitwise.com, is where you go. Go to Google Play, type in Blitwise. You will find their games as well. And on iTunes, same thing. They just search for Blitwise, and they'll find your stuff.
That's right. You can search for Blitwise and Pocket Tanks, usually.
And don't forget, these same games are available also on the PC and Mac, right? So if you don't want to run your cell phone battery into the ground playing, why play on your PC?
Yes, though I would encourage you to run your cell phone battery into the ground and then switch over to the PC and play there until it's charged up again. That's my advice.
That sounds like a perfect deal. Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking almost 2 hours out of your busy time. I know you have much to do before the holidays come, and we thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Shane. It was absolutely wonderful to have an opportunity to talk. We're old friends. It's fun to catch up and do an interview and talk about new stuff, too. It's been wonderful. So thanks again, and I hope you have a Merry Christmas.
You too as well. And from everybody here at Retro Gaming Radio, this is what we do. We interview the people that matter. We interview the people that have the stories to tell, and obviously we're not afraid to ask any question, even if it revolves around crack cocaine. All right. This is Shane Armandrow with Retro Gaming Radio. We'll see you next time.
Yep.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Once again, big thanks to Michael Welch for joining us on the show. Take 2 hours out of his time to sit and shoot the breeze with us. We really appreciate it. And this will not be the only interview you're going to hear in 2013. We have several different interviews lined up for you. We think you're going to enjoy it. And don't worry, the anniversaries will return in the January 2013 edition. Just try to keep the show a little bit manageable when we have these long interviews. I hate cutting up the interviews into two shows. People said they didn't like it, so we're not going to do that anymore. If humanly possible, we'll try to keep the interviews all together in one show. So I hope you enjoyed the interview. Join us again next month when we have a new anniversary segment right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month I'm pleased to announce that Space Ace, the Don Bluth, Rick Dyer Laserdisc video game is finally available for Android. Now, it's been available, let's be honest, Space Ace and Dragon's Lair have been available on every platform since the beginning of time. However, Space Ace has been noticeably absent from the Android platform, my platform of choice for playing these sort of games. And finally, Space Ace is out. And there's some good stories behind it. I was going to take and make a much larger review out of Space Ace. But I've talked about Space Ace before. You know what the game is. You've seen it before. So I'm going to lightly cover what the game is. And then I'm going to tell you a really cool story about the Android version of Space Ace. Because that's what you pay me for. Or don't pay me for, as it were. Space Ace, of course, is the follow-up to the immensely successful Dragon's Lair arcade game. Laserdisc-based Don Bluth, master animator, left Disney to start his own studio, created some of the greatest video of all time, some of the greatest animation of all time, personal hero and friend of mine, by the way. Don Bluth's a great guy. And his animation for Dragon's Lair, Secret of Nim, in my opinion, is like the greatest animated tale of all time. Forget Disney. I think Secret of Nim, made when Don and Gary Goldman and John Pomeroy, when these guys were starving, when they were hungry, when they left Disney on principle, this was their showpiece. This was, you know, we want success more than anything, and this is how we're going to do it. And Secret of Nim, in my opinion, is the greatest animated film of all time. So, with that being said, what can we expect from Don Bluth in a video game? Well, Don Bluth, of course, did the animation for Dragon's Lair and Space Ace, as well as some of Dragon's Lair 2. That's a whole other story. Space Ace takes the Dragon's Lair mantra, which is essentially quick time events. You did not so much play Dragon's Lair as you kept the movie going. And Space Ace is the same way. The video starts playing, and you have to tap buttons and or a controller to help guide the hero in the direction he needs to go. It's not a one-to-one relationship. You're not running around the screen, you know, moving your guy by holding left or holding right. It's a quick time event. If you've played Resident Evils, if you've played several of the games out there, Shenmue, you'll know what quick time events are. Essentially, you have to, this whole game is nothing but a big quick time event, which some people would call like playing video version of Simon. Yeah. Is that legit? Probably. However, where Dragon's Lair was very, very linear, Space Ace offered you far more in the way of moves, alternate paths, and difficulty levels. So Space Ace was really Dragon's Lair fully realized into as much of a game as you can make a Laserdisc game into. The story has the evil Commander Borf stealing your girlfriend, Kimberly, if you will, and you have been hit by the Infanto Ray, the Borf's magic little weapon, and you've gone from the stellar Space Ace down to the adorable but dorky-ass Dexter. You play the game both as Dexter and Space Ace throughout the game. Occasionally, the ray will wear off, and you'll have an opportunity to energize and become Space Ace long enough to get through a particular battle, and then you'll de-evolve back to Dexter. Now, the cool thing is throughout the game, there's probably, and I haven't done the math, you'd think so, and you'll understand why I should know this number, but I don't off the top of my head. There's about 10 different instances that you can energize. The neat thing is you can play almost the entire game without ever once energizing, which a lot of people don't know. When the screen flashes red and says energize, you push the button. You're told to push the button, you push the button. But in almost every single case, you do not have to energize. Which is kind of cool because it gives you a completely new way of doing things, a different route, a different, totally different moves. So that's actually fantastic. There's also three levels of difficulty. Now, in Ace mode, I think it takes you about, and again, I should know this number down pat, but I do not. Without dying, I think you can finish the Ace level in about 15 to 20 minutes. That's going through a mixture of the long paths, which is energizing, and the not-so-long paths, which is skipping the energizing, and finishing each level as Dexter. However, there's three difficulty levels. Each one offers not just more of the same. It's not just playing, if you play on Cadet, then you play this, but if you play on Captain, you play Cadet with all the scenes in reverse. There's actually different scenes. Again, very cool. Very different than Dragon's Lair. Even if Dragon's Lair wasn't your cup of tea, if you enjoy the concept of quick time events, Space Ace might actually be more pleasurable for you. Plus, it's a space thing, which is kind of cool. You know, laser guns. It's got really good music. Dragon's Lair was very sparse. There wasn't a lot of music going on. There was very little voiceover work. There were grunts. There were minor sound effects. You can tell it was put together on a budget. Now, Space Ace, you could tell they had some money. Full orchestral track, tons of voiceover work. You can tell a little bit more money was given to Space Ace. And of course, nobody remembers Space Ace. They remember Dragon's Lair, which is kind of sad. I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, I'm Mr. Dragon's Lair. Truth is, I'm more Mr. Space Ace than Dragon's Lair. So there you go. That's sort of a quick overview of what is Space Ace. Now let's talk about, well, so obviously Space Ace is important to me, right? Dragon's Lair was important, but Space Ace was more so because that was more my favorite game between the two, despite my constant discussions about Dragon's Lair. Now, as with Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, these games require, these games elicit a particular pattern matching that's very audible in nature. So, have you ever heard, now maybe some of you remember this, there were a couple of videos floating around, I'm sure you can find them on YouTube, of people playing Dragon's Lair with being blindfolded or backwards, standing at the arcade cabinet backwards, playing it without watching the screen at all. And that's because these games are rich with audible cues, music changes, sound effects. These things, for most people who've actually played these games more than once or twice as some sort of a passing fancy at the arcade, you know what I'm talking about. There's timing that you get used to based on sound effects, even if you're watching the game. So what makes one version of Space Ace or Dragon's Lair better or worse than another one? I mean, how much different can they be? It's the same video. The real key is, what about the moves? What about the timing of the moves? If these aren't accurate, now, will most people, will the casual player ever catch any of this stuff? No. They don't care that you cannot energize and jump into the pipe instead of energizing against the red laser guy. The screen's going to say energize, they're going to do it. They're not going to even realize there was an alternate move there, right? So these alternate moves, the timing based on audio cues, sometimes they allowed you to do more than one move to be successful. Sometimes if, like in Dragon's Lair, when you were going through Yi Rapids, right, and the barrel you're on splashes up and there's a chain hanging next to you and you have to grab the chain, it's acceptable to push either forward or right to grab the chain. Both moves are acceptable. Now, if you've played your entire life pushing up to grab the chain, and suddenly you get a version of Dragon's Lair that you can't push up, it requires you to go right. These are the sort of things. It's just like Pac-Man. You know, if you play a game of Pac-Man that isn't set for the same patterns as the arcade game, like if you go out and buy a Jack-specific controller and you play Pac-Man on there, it looks kind of like Pac-Man, it sounds kind of like Pac-Man, the ghosts don't go in the same patterns. There's anything that you've learned in the past about Pac-Man doesn't help you. These are the sort of things that piss the purists off. And when it comes to Space Ace, Dragon's Lair, especially Space Ace, I am a purist. I require accuracy. Now, Space Ace and Dragon's Lair both have been completely emulated by something called Daphne. Using the video discs that you can purchase from Digital Leisure, you can actually decode all of that video, put it onto your hard drive, and use Daphne to play a 100% emulated version of Space Ace and Dragon's Lair. It will be as if you are at the arcade, period, no questions asked. Unfortunately, very few people are going to use Daphne. Not that want to play a casual game of Space Ace or a casual game of Dragon's Lair. Daphne's not available on Android or iOS devices. So how do you get your fix on the go, on your mobile phone, on your tablet? How do you get that? Well, you're stuck using what I call simulated versions of Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. Now, when Dragon's Lair came out, every time Dragon's Lair and Space Ace come out from a different platform, I get it and I review it. People expect me to do this for them. I've become sort of an authority on accuracy in these games. Well, I know that Space Ace, for the last few months, I've known that it was coming. I just didn't know when. Well, a few weeks back, I contacted my contacts up at Digital Leisure, and I said, hey, I hear Space Ace is in the pipe. Will we see it before Christmas? And David Foster, he runs Digital Leisure up there, and Paul Gold, he's a good guy. He's like their sales rep. And so I deal with both of them. And I met his wife, David's wife, Elizabeth Foster, up at an E3, like back in 2004, I think. Very nice lady. So very nice people up there. But their thought process, rightfully so, is that accuracy is a bonus, you know. People who play Dragon's Lair on a tablet or a cell phone or on a Wii or on a 360, as long as it's pretty close, that's good enough for us. And I get that. From a business point of view, it completely makes sense. And for year after year, every time a new version comes out, I will send them a list of the things that I have found that do not work properly compared to the emulator version. Now, I don't have a Space Ace machine here. I do have a fully complete working Daphne setup, though. So I can play Space Ace as if I were in the arcade. And believe me, I can tell you what's wrong with one of these simulations. Now, when it came out for iOS not that long ago, I believe earlier this year, to be honest, I could care less if it's accurate. I believe most iOS people aren't going to give a rat's ass if it's accurate or not. However, Android people, at least a lot of the Android people I know, are PC fanatics. They are the ones that are playing that remember back. I think that there's a distinctive market cut between Android and iOS. So, you know, plus I don't have an iOS device, so I couldn't test it anyway. However, Android, I wanted to make sure was done right. So I was already waiting for it to get released so I could send my list of fixes to them. Which is funny because I've done this before. You would think, and this is no hit against Digital Leisure, but you would think that if I sent them all of these lists of moves and changes and fixes, that they would simply incorporate that into their master moves database or whatever it is, because they've got to have these things all... they've got to have these things all stored somewhere, and I know they do because they told me. And this database was made like 20 friggin' years ago, and it was made by watching video played by somebody playing Space Ace on the actual machine. That's great. The problem is that video only shows that player's rendition of the game. You know, it's not going to show you necessarily all the alternate paths or all the alternate moves. Because if it did, I wouldn't have all these huge lists of issues every single time a new version of this comes out. Anyway, that's beside the point. I'm just happy that I finally got Space Ace on my Nexus 10, and it looks gorgeous, by the way. So, anyway, let me get back to the story. I digress. So I wrote them, and I said, are we going to see it by Christmas? And David Foster wrote me back, and he said, yeah. He said, you'll have it by Christmas, and he's like, do you want a beta to copy? And I'm like, yeah. Are you kidding me? I said, I will work very hard for you. I said, give me a beta copy. I've got Android machines all over the place. I'll test it on the Nexus 10, the Nexus 7, the Galaxy Nexus, the S3, the, what else did I test it on? I tested it on something else. Oh, the Transformer 101. I said, I got all these devices. And he says, this would be great if you could get us kind of a spot test before we release. And I said, great. So I got it down, and I started playing it, and of course, it's littered with missing moves, missing sequences, missing video, standard stuff that I see every single release. And I said, I wrote back, and I said, listen, David, I know that accuracy's not your watchword, but here's a list of things that I put together so far that I've seen. And to my surprise, he said, oh, I passed on your fixes to the Android developer. I'm like, whoa, really? All right. So I continued my testing. I found several UI glitches between the Android devices because I knew that that was important to them to get the release out. Moves can be fixed later, but you don't want a bad high score table or, bad UI elements. So for about 4 days straight, because I didn't know how long they were going to let me continue to submit this stuff. I was going to get it all. I played through, oh my God, I played through Space Ace about 100 times on all three difficulty levels on Daphne, just to make sure that I remembered everything the way that I remembered. It's been 20 years, I could have some deficiencies. So I went through and I tested all of my moves. I tested all of the things. I compared them back to back. At one time, I had Daphne running on the computer screen. I had my Nexus 10 sitting on my lap, and I was comparing them like scene by scene. I was shooting video of the two of them. I was doing picture in a picture to show them what pieces were missing from the scene. I really worked hard on this. And day after day after day, build after build after build, they would send me the fixes. And I worked with a guy named Miguel, and I owe him big because he was the one that was willing to take on the extra workload to make the accurate changes. And so it got to the point where we set up Google Drive. I had a shared folder with the Digital Leisure team and myself. I was uploading the videos, showing the disparate moves. I was doing this. I was doing that. I was submitting notes every day. It really was like a QA process. For those of you who are in software development, we really did a full QA deal. Now, normally, I would have been thrilled if one or two minor things would have been fixed. You know, what I call big things. I mean, they're minor to them, but they're huge to me. But I will tell you this, and this is why there's only one version of Space Ace you should own, and that's the Android version, or Daphne. If you're already playing it on Daphne, then, you know, you're playing the best that there is, period, hands down. There's no discussion here. However, if you want a commercial turnkey version, yours truly will tell you that hour after hour, I'm going to go on a limb and say I probably put about 40 to 50 man hours in QAing this between playing the original, doing video capture, all that stuff, all of the things that I did, probably 40 to 50 hours of work to ensure that this one time, at least, this one version on the platform I love the most, Android, for the game, one of the games I love the most, Space Ace, we were going to get the most accurate version possible. And I've got to hand it to the team, both Miguel and David Foster. I mean, they have to pay Miguel, I'm assuming. So David Foster had to put money into this to ensure that this was accurate. So huge thank yous to both, everybody that made this possible. They fixed everything. Every single issue I submitted, they fixed. Now, I'm going to tell you a couple of them that they did not fix, and it was not because they weren't willing to, but because of a technical hurdle that they had to deal with that simply jumped way out of scope. And I get it. There's a couple of decisions you have to make, and it did not crush me to have to lose this one little thing. And most people would never know, but you're going to know now because I'm going to tell you. But let me give you the overview. There's actually two things that are wrong with the Android version of Space Ace. And when I say wrong, I mean features that are not implemented. Nothing missing, nothing wrong, just features not implemented. Now, let me explain what I'm talking about. If you play Space Ace on cadet level and you have enough lives, the game will all but finish itself. When you die on the cadet level of Space Ace, it jumps you ahead past the move that you died. So, technically speaking, if you have enough lives, and believe me, I tested this. I had Space Ace running on Daphne with infinite lives on cadet level, and that game will continue until it gets to the end of the game. I do not believe it will do the final move for you. You have to do the final move yourself. But other than that, that game will play itself all the way through as long as you've got enough lives to keep skipping each move that you die on. That is not implemented in any commercial version of Space Ace that I can remember seeing. So it's not just an Android problem. It's all problems because the way that the logic and the engine's written, it does not accommodate for that. I'm okay with that. Instead, it restarts the scene that you're on. In most games, that's the way it works anyway. However, it's worth noting that that is one inaccuracy between the arcade and this version. The second inaccuracy is only seen on the Ace level when you play the highest level of the game, highest difficulty level. There are a couple of scenes, like the space garbage compactor level. There's another one. Which one was it? The red tunnel, the red laser tunnel. There's a couple of these that if you are on Ace, playing Ace level, Ace difficulty, I should say, and there's a point where essentially you play the scene one and a half times or two times, depending on the scene. If you die over halfway through, then it starts you at the halfway point. So in other words, if you're playing the red tunnel sequence, you get through the first half, and then they play it in reverse for the second half. If you get through the forward version, into the reverse version, and die, you don't go back to the beginning of the forward version. You go back to the beginning of the reverse version. That's how it plays in the arcade. That's how it plays emulated. However, in the Android version of Space Ace, you go back to the beginning of the forward level. And that has to do with video continuity and some other things. And you know what? That's it. Those are the only things that are wrong with Space Ace. Can you believe that? They tightened up dozens of moves, not just moves. There's a couple of different things. Let me go through this because I know you guys are interested, at least some of you. Move windows. So there's a couple of different things. There's the correct move, when to do the move, but also a window of opportunity when you can do the move. It's not enough to just move forward or up. You have to do it at the right time. But there's also a window of opportunity. How long, for how many nanoseconds, milliseconds, full seconds, how long is that move good for? That's what we call the move window. Sometimes the move is correct, the alternate move is correct, but the move window is too short or too wide or it's offset. For example, in spaces, I'll give you an example. On the Space Cats, where you energize, and then this giant, huge monster scoops you up. And then you shoot him in the mouth, he drops you, you run across this bridge, and the big space monster slams his arm into the walkway that you're walking on. And you have to hit a move at that point in order to stop from running into him. That move window was short. So they wanted you to do the move prematurely. So I had to go three times back into that and say, listen, the move window starts here at about this point in the video, and it ends about this point in the video. When his arm hits that wall, you should be able to hit the fire button at that moment. So they opened up that window a little bit. So these are the sort of things that we went through back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, fixing. And for any time there was a controversy of, well, you know, that's different than what we have in our notes. I said, okay, listen, I will record the emulated version. I'll take the Android version. I'll put them side by side. And you can see that the movement windows are off. So I would do that. So listen, and I'll get right back to the point. This is the definitive version of Space Ace. Other than playing it on Daphne, there is no other platform to play Space Ace on. If Space Ace means that much to you, you better get an Android device. I recommend a Nexus 7. Inexpensive, beautiful screen, powerful. You want Space Ace. If you want a portable version of Space Ace, if you want a commercial version of Space Ace, if you want a version that doesn't require hours of ripping videos and setting up emulation, blah, 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 this is it. And will the iOS version get updated with these fixes? Probably not. Will you ever get to play this on the Wii or the Wii U this well emulated? Probably not. Are they going to go back and fix the Xbox version or the DVD-ROM version with these move fixes? No. What about the Space Ace Blu-ray? Are you going to get the updates on that? No. Now, will they take my move sets moving forward and incorporate them? Maybe, maybe not. It's hard to say. So, this is the bottom line. You want Space Ace. You want it as accurate as possible. You want it signed off by me, Mr. Dron Bluth, Mr. Dragonslayer, Mr. Space Ace. This is it. It's available, I believe, for $4.99 on Google Play. Just like Dragonslayer, it also allows you to download the highest level of assets that your device will display. Now, if you've got a Nexus 10, you're out of luck. They do not have what I would call the Ultra HD version, or the Retina version, running at 2250 by 1640 or whatever the crazy resolution on the Nexus 10 is. However, you will be perfectly happy with the HD version that it downloads. Believe me, it looks fantastic. So, once again, I'm going to wrap this up. Space Ace on Android, the most accurate, insured by me. Look at the credits. I'm in the credits. insured by me as being the most accurate version of Space Ace ever available commercially. Outside of emulation, outside of owning the machine, you have my seal of approval. And I've been dying to give you my seal of approval for the better part of two decades. Now you've got it. So now you know what you got to do. Go buy Space Ace Google Play $4.99. I hope you enjoyed this, and be sure to check out our reviews on another episode of Retro Gaming Radio coming soon. One of our quick reviews this month, we're going to be looking at the Pinball Arcade's table, Star Trek The Next Generation. Now, normally I wouldn't give a new table this much time on the show, but I think it's a rather important table. It's one of the best tables ever created, actually, in my opinion. I think it's definitely on my top 10 favorite tables of all time. And the Pinball Arcade actually has it. But there's some neat stories behind how this came about, so I figured it'd be worth our time to sit and talk about it. Now, we all know Star Trek The Next Generation was a very popular pinball. I believe it was a Steve Ritchie table, which made it all the more popular. Now, what makes this table so great is it's possibly one of the best combinations of what makes pinball great, including things like missions, and table layout, spinners, drop shoots. All of the things that we really love about pinball have been perfectly crafted into this. And let's not forget the IP, right? Star Trek The Next Generation, huge, huge television show, tons of movies, and many people argue it's the best Star Trek of all time. My opinions vary on that. I like all the Star Treks, well, almost all of them, for different reasons. But that's neither here nor there. The table itself is absolutely gorgeous. It's loaded with Star Trek IP. There's Star Trek sound effects. There's Next Generation. A lot of the cast is there. You'll hear Picard. You'll hear Geordi. You'll hear, I believe you hear Troy in there. You'll hear Data. So it's really nice to have that sort of consistency. And I'm 99% sure, could be wrong, that these are all the original actors, right? They do not sound like sound-alikes, if you will. And as you know, if you listen to the David Thiel interview, and if you have not, you're seriously missing out. Go back and check out the David Thiel interview. Everything you want to know about sound and pinball, he's your guy. But they sound like the authentic characters, and you can tell that they were actually recorded on session. They weren't clipped out of a show or an episode where you hear a lot of the pinball machines were done with just clips from the show. So that's very cool as well. And of course, it's just a good game of pinball. Now, here's the big problem. It's a Williams table, and Williams, of course, is very popular, coin-op, pinball, etc., right? So one of my favorite pinballs of all time, Black Knight 2000, Williams table. And Star Trek itself is a huge, huge IP. Right, so you've got a lot of different cost issues when trying to recreate this table professionally. There's a reason why companies like Zen Pinball, which we've talked about in the past, and other software pinball, Pro Pinball, there's tons of different companies, Epic Pinball, there's tons of different pinball packages. And most of them, in fact, almost all of them, are all original tables. And there's a reason behind that. Original tables are cheaper. What you really need to do is get somebody very competent in pinball design to come in and create you a fully original table. That's actually probably easier than trying to go through the licensing process. Now, again, I refer you back to the David Thiel interview where he talked about how unusual it was to work with Disney and to work with other companies trying to license and get this sort of thing put together. Now, this is a huge undertaking, and the studio that puts together the Pinball Arcade, they had to make a choice on how they were going to provide this particular product to the market. Now, as you may or may not know, these things are expensive to license. And so, while Farsight Studios has done a lot of licensing in the past, they have typically been, shall we say, not top 10 type tables like Star Trek. I'll give you the rundown. Let me just run through some of these tables for you, just to give you kind of an idea what I'm talking about. These are the ones that are easier to license, right? Big Shot, Black Hole. There's a ton of Williams in here, too. The original Black Knight. We have Circus Voltaire, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Elvira, Party Monsters, Funhouse, Gorgar, Harley Davidson, Medieval Madness. Now, granted, there's some high-profile tables in the collection. I can keep going, but I'll be here all day talking about it. Elvira tables. There's still some top-notch tables in here. But when you're talking about the hard-to-license tables, you're talking about things like Twilight Zone, which, by the way, is in the Pinball Arcade now. You're talking about Addams Family, which is not anywhere digitally. And, of course, you're talking about tables like Star Trek. So the amount of cash that they would have needed to put forth to get this title to work out would have been extraordinary. But they still wanted to do it. They had a very nice machine. And if you haven't seen the video, I'll see if Alex can pull that up for you on RGR Plus TV. There was a very nice, I think, 15, 16-minute video from Farsight Studios where they actually show you the process of obtaining the pinball machine, restoring it completely. Then they go in and do 3D digitizing, 3D sampling of the entire table, recreate all the labels, recreate all the lights, all the gels. Everything gets completely recreated perfectly. It's put into their engine. It's a huge process. Well, that process is huge no matter what the table is, whether it's something like Big Shot, or it's something like Twilight Zone or Star Trek. So the cost is the same. However, now you're talking about getting the licensing put together. Now, I don't have actual numbers in front of me, but I'm pretty sure it was a fairly significant number. To offset the cost, to actually bring us the table, Farsight Studios went out and started a Kickstarter project and said, listen, this is a huge table. It's going to cost us a fortune. We got to pay Williams. We got to pay Paramount. We got to do this. We got to do that. We got to secure all this stuff. I can't even imagine the lawyer fees involved of chasing down, a pinball machine of this caliber and getting all the permissions and all that stuff. It's got to cost a fortune. So they did a Kickstarter project. I personally contributed $10, and for that price, I would get a copy of it on the platform of choice, which my choice will probably be on the Wii U when it ships for the Wii U here shortly, because I went ahead and purchased it on Android when it came out. So not only did I pay the $10 for the Kickstarter, but I also paid full price for the table. Now, a lot of people have been complaining lately, and their complaints are justified. We've been paying about $2.99 per table in the Pinball Arcade. $4.99 will get you a set of two tables, normally speaking, from the collection. However, lately, the tables like Twilight Zone and Star Trek have both clocked in at $4.99 apiece. Now, that's a little bit pricey. Now, you got to think about it. It's $5. We are in the day and age where people don't want to spend any money to buy anything. They want everything for free, yada, yada, yada. However, realization will eventually settle in, and people are going to realize they can't play everything for free. They're going to have to pony up sometimes. And I think that the fans, the people who really, really need these sort of tables, are willing to put forth the money. I know I was. So for $5, it'll get you the table, and you can actually upgrade. I think for $7.99, you can get the Pro Mode, which lets you go in and tinker with all of the operator settings. Now, that's been another point of discussion lately. Recently, they've been putting this nasty-looking, almost an ad, if you will, on top of the interface. When you would scroll through the interface to find the table that you want, there'd be this ugly GoPro logo plastered over the table, and a lot of people were upset about it. However, they did listen, and they've changed the UI to a landscape orientation, which people are going to complain about that too, and they have. There's no portrait orientation, it's all landscape now, which they've now moved the GoPro somewhere a little less annoying. Now, on my Nexus 10, the UI still needs a little bit of work, but I understand it looks very good on the Nexus 7. So, sort of an evolution of the Pinball Arcade, if you will. So, how does the table stand up? I mean, what's the whole point of table emulation is you want pure emulation, right? You want as good as you can get. So, I will tell you that the table is absolutely pristine. Now, most of you know, if you've ever played a Next Generation pinball in the wild, if you've played Star Trek Next Generation in the wild, there's usually a couple of very weak flippers, usually on the right-hand side, which of course are the money makers. And there's always something that doesn't quite work right. Now, one of the cool things about Star Trek The Next Generation is it actually has a loadable gun, actually two loadable guns, that the ball slides into this little cannon, and the cannon starts moving, and then you shoot the ball out of the cannon at a particular target or drop hole. And those are the sort of things that no matter how good of a condition you find a Star Trek in the wild, you know, the damn things, there's always something wrong with it. There's always something not quite right, and of course that is frustrating. The best part about digital, a lot of people don't like digital because it's not real pinball. I understand the purist point of view as well. I own a Bone Busters, and as far as I know, there's no electronic version of Bone Busters. So I can't really compare that directly. However, I will tell you that Star Trek is an excellently done table. All of the things that are usually glitchy on a real table are actually 100% working, and they never go bad. So that flipper's never going to get looser than it is right now. It's always going to have the same push to it. So you can consistently play similar games over and over and over again and get actually good at the game, which is a huge plus for digital pinball. So the Star Trek table is very accurate. All of the sound effects are there. I've not noticed anything cut. The table plays very well. There are no huge glitches that I found. I had the ball hang in one location, but I think it would have hung on the original machine too. For the most part, though, the game plays completely accurate. Now, in the early days, for those of you who are following me on Google Plus and my other social media, you may have noticed I complained about it on the Nexus 10. One thing I've got to say about Farsight Studios, while they do tend to mess a couple things up from time to time, they're very quick to go in and fix their mistakes. And in this case, they did very well. They went in and fixed a rotational bug that people were complaining about. They were forcing you into landscape orientation, and nobody with an Android tablet that actually has actual widescreen orientation, not that 4:3 ratio crap that the iPad has, they will tell you that they want to play it in portrait mode. So being able to play portrait on Android is huge. Now, I can't, this table is available on iOS as well. However, as usual, I do not have an iOS device, so I cannot give you a comparison. All I can do is tell you how clean or not clean that the Android version is. But that rotational bug was causing me a problem on my Nexus 10. Essentially, the table would play like 10 frames per second. It was terrible. The ball jumped all over the place. It was completely unplayable, and I voiced my concern. Once the patch came down and fixed the rotation, amazingly enough, it fixed the Nexus 10. So I've had a chance to play it arduously over the course of the last couple of weeks while I've been on vacation, and I got to say, it's a top-notch title. Is it worth your $5? Well, that's for you to say. The table is top-notch. It's completely well done. It's everything you remember. It's everything you're going to have against the actual machine. Incredibly well done. That's all I'm going to say. If the Star Trek Next Generation IP appeals to you, to me, the table's worth $5. It's just that simple. Now, is it worth $5 to you? That's a choice you'll have to make. As a pinball aficionado, as somebody who thinks Star Trek is one of the top 10, 15 pinballs of all time, I would say it's definitely worth $5. It's worth your time to go in and check it out. It's a gorgeous table. It's loads of fun, and I do not think you would be disappointed. So check it out. Star Trek The Next Generation, now available in the Pinball Arcade, available for both Android and iOS, and soon, by the way, coming to the Wii U, supposedly in January sometime. So we'll keep an eye out for that. And with any luck, I won't have to buy all these tables again. But I have a weird feeling that certain tables I'm going to have to buy again. So anyway, hope you enjoyed this mini review. We'll be checking in with the pinball simulators from time to time. I know a lot of people are into pinball that listen to Retro Gaming Radio, and this is important stuff to them. So we're going to keep giving you what you need right here on Retro Gaming Radio. What the heck, we're having a pinball sort of day, so let's talk about another interesting little pinball table called Revenge of the Rob-O-Bot. Now, this is a standalone table. It's not part of a package. It's not part of the Pinball Arcade or Zen Pinball. It's an original table, and I checked it out because it was on a sale list for 99 cents, And I think it is throughout the holidays. So a $1 table is a good deal, right? We just talked about Star Trek and some other tables being, you know, $2.99, $4.99 or more. So this is for a buck. So it's really hard to overlook something like this. So anyway, this is a very classically put together pinball table. It reminds me a lot of some of the earlier days of pinball, electronic pinball. It's fully featured. Let me start with that. There's some pinball that's available that's just, you know, they don't put a lot of work into it. Now, you can tell that this was designed by professional pinball designers. This was not something that was thrown together. This has five different missions. It's got realistic physics. I'm reading this off their Google playlist if you hadn't figured that out. Retro display animation, so it uses the LED display boards. 5-ball multi-ball. 10 evil robots to defeat, tons of combos, bonuses, and multiplier, tilts, global high score list. So it's a very well done board. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you other than the fact that the board's very well put together. It's very pleasant. It's very old style looking. It looks like an old style pinball machine, but it still has all the features of a modern pinball machine, and that's important. It's got the ramps, it's got the rails, it's got a couple of toys on the screen, but nothing huge. It's got a main robot that you knock down his little shield, but it's not huge. But the dot matrix display has animations, and it does all the things that you would want it to do. And again, for a buck, it's really hard to go wrong. So if you're really into pinball and you're looking for yet another table to add to your collection, you've burned through Star Trek The Next Generation, you're looking for a cheap way of getting into another table, if you're a table collector like I am, then it's definitely worth checking this out. Now, it's worth noting that this Nina Innovations AB, that's the name of the company that makes it, also has a ton of other $1 boards, including one called Dino Madness Pinball, Nina Mark II, and Pinball Crazy Castle. Now, I haven't looked at any of these, so I can't tell you, but I can tell you that Dino Madness has a light version for free. There's a Christmas pinball that they have available as well. So these guys specialize in single tables, and again, they're all on sale right now, so you might as well get in on them while you can. You figure, there's five or six bucks, buck a piece. It's fantastic. It looks like a lot of fun. And I'm peeking at some of these other tables. There's videos of all the tables, so you can go check it out and see if it rubs you right, if you like the IP or not. Very nice. So definitely check it out. These also look very, very nice on 10-inch tablets. A lot of pinball machines, these cheap pinballs that you get on the Google Play Store, most of them don't look very good on larger tablets. The graphics get stretched right, et cetera. These look very, very nice on 10-inch. So they've really done a good job of scaling these graphics up and making them look good, even on the higher resolution devices. So definitely check it out. If you search Google Play for Nina Innovation, N-E-N-A, Innovation, you'll see not only this Revenge of the Robot, but you'll also see the Christmas one, the Dino Madness, Dino Madness, Pinball Crazy. So definitely check them out. You know, again, for a buck a piece, it's hard to go wrong. Pinball lovers beware. There are more pinball machines out there now than ever available right on your Android devices. And I do believe I read somewhere that these are available on iOS. So if you are an iOS kind of guy or gal, let me double check here. Yeah, iPhone, iPad, and Android. So definitely check them out. Again, that's Revenge of the Robot. I'm assuming that's robot. We'll check it out. Available right now for 99 cents, available at Google Play, and I'm assuming at the App Store. So check it out. One of my listeners sent it in. I believe, Nick, your last name's eluding me at the moment, and I don't have it in my notes, but thank you for sending that one my way. Much appreciated. Well, folks, that's going to wrap up this episode of Retro Gaming Radio. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next month, we should be back to our normal schedule, with any luck. And hopefully I'll be over this upper respiratory infection that's making me sound like a 20-year chain smoker. Anyway, do be sure to join us on our social networks. Twitter, you can reach us at Retro Gaming Radio, minus the O at the end. I don't know why. They just have a limit to how many characters you can have in your name. And you can also join us at Google Plus, search for Retro Gaming Radio. Please also listen to classic editions of Retro Gaming Radio, the early years of Retro Gaming Radio, available on our Shoutcast server. Go to shoutcast.com, type in Retro Gaming Radio to get the goods. That's helpfully put together by Alex J. Lopez, the producer here. And again, feel free to hit up the website, submit your news, submit your stories, information right to us right at RetroGamingRadio.com. I also understand that there is a problem with the disc ordering system to order discs if you're using the Chrome browser, which is weird because I thought I tested it on the Chrome browser. But I will be taking a look at that as well this holiday season, and we should have that up and running. So those of you who are interested in ordering some of the classic editions on DVD, you'll be able to do so as well. This is Shane R. Monroe saying until next time, keep it retro.